Listen to the Carbcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under the Carbcast, or check our website at www.thecarbcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course. To the Carbcast, introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chops. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
Welcome to Take 5 of episode 41 of the Carbcast. We're struggling to get this going for many, many reasons. One of which is because Mark's actually fishing. Is that right?
It is, and I've had a bit of a nightmare getting myself sorted, but I'm kind of all done now. I say all done. My rods are out. I've got a bit of bait out there. Yeah, I'm fishing it. It's long, but not silly range. And I've had quite a squally crosswind, which is... not exactly help things, so just as I thought, sod it, I'll finish me spotting up and get some more bait out once we've finished recording. As soon as we sit down, the wind drops.
There's nothing worse, is there, than battling with the elements all day, getting your rod sorted, not really being 100% happy, and then once you settle down, the wind drops and you could have gotten perfect, and you sat there with a conundrum. Do I redo them all and potentially go through 2 or 3 hours more stress right on bite time, or do I just leave them from the wind cast and the bow in the line and all the other things that have probably happened?
To be fair, I'm happy with the way the rods have gone out. You know, I know the swim, I know the spot. And in fact, if anyone's watched the video I've put on the Carbcast YouTube channel, I did one called Morning Madness. I'm sat in that swim.
Ah, in the same swim. Okay. And you're confident? Yeah. Any fish about?
No. No, I've seen a couple around this end of the lake, but you know, so far out, there's nothing I can do about it. But the I don't know if I mentioned before on the Carbcast, but the sailing club have dyed the lake to kill all the weed. You know, because it was, even in a lake this big, the Canadian was just literally choking the entire lake, and it ruined the sailing meets, and you know, cost them quite a bit of money, to be honest.
Yeah, it can't be cheap, so, dyeing a lake that big.
No, I've heard 16 grand mentioned.
Wow.
But then again, if they need to keep the sailing meets and keep the members paying, you know, it has to be done, and it has worked.
What?
But what happens then? The carp become nomads. There's nothing to hold them in any area, especially right now after the winter.
What?
I found...
go on.
I did pull a bit of silkweed in earlier on, so I'll put it straight back.
Replanted it.
Yeah, I am. I put it under a marginal tree, so I'm going to watch it grow and fish it.
Yeah, this on weedy lakes, I've heard of people, you know, like dragging tarpaulin out and weighting it down with bricks and stone to make clear areas in weedy lakes. You're going to be doing it the other way around. You're going to be swimming out with bankside vegetation and planting it and you know, marking the location, yeah, of the weed hotspots.
Yeah, man, that's what I did last year. The, you know, the Canadian is pretty much almost obliterated. But there were several quite large patches of the eelgrass, and they did even reach the surface. But on that video that I mentioned, in this swim, there was even a flat spot. It reached the surface that much, and I'm now fishing slightly beyond where I was then. And I've got 6 foot with a marker float, and the water's a foot up on what it was this time, well, when I fished it during that session.
Wow.
So it's quite a shallow spot. But I think around 6 or 7 a foot is the threshold for this dye. Anything below it just can't photosynthesize. It doesn't get the sunlight. But, you know, in the shallower spots, they do get the weed, and I've just ruined this swim for myself for the rest of the season because everyone's going to fish it.
Very probably. Moving on, there's quite a bit to go over in this episode. We're going to cover the Carpcast social that we had on Cromer Lake last weekend.
That was fun.
Yeah, it was a great weekend. We probably sold out the rest of the socials off the back of it already. I'm pretty sure by the time this show's gone out, it will be full up. But if you are interested, then do contact Mark. I had the pleasure of interviewing Mark Bryant last week while I was fishing. Mark, if you don't know him, he's owns Baitworks, which is a bait company, and they're not just one of these one man band shed companies, as we call them, of which some of them are great, I know, but Mark's he has a factory, a unit, all the machines. Simon Scott, Carpcast favorite, is involved in all the testing and stuff, and does the tank tests on the fish and involved in the science of it all. And Mark's also a fantastic guy. He came very close to death last year, extremely close. He, by rights, he should be dead. There was about three twists of fate, as he will explain, that any one of these didn't happen in the sequence that it happened, then he wouldn't be here now. So it's quite inspirational, talking to somebody who cheated, really did cheat death. He's also involved heavily in his local area, which is the Cotswold Water Park, and he holds events to raise money for local clubs. And we had a conversation basically about that there should be someone in every area really taking on that mantle. They're helping out the actual club waters with stocks of fish and management of the lakes and stuff, because clubs are generally low or non-profit. Then it's not a commercial syndicate or something making somebody loads of money, and I think it's really important to keep clubs active in each area. We discuss a lot of things, the Carp Society stuff, with it being just down the road from Horseshoe Lake, and he's obviously been heavily involved in that area for a lot of years, and it's a really interesting interview, I think. So we hope you enjoy it. That's coming up later. We're going to have the listeners' live questions that we did on the Carpcast social. Apologies if it's a little bit drunken or rowdy. We're going to put it at the end of the show for that reason. It's nearly an hour of Julian and myself and Mark answering questions. It might not be to everybody's cup of tea, just because a few drinks had been consumed and it's a big group of people together, so it won't ruin the rest of the show for you if it's not your thing, but there's definitely some good information in there. It certainly is worth checking out. But we'll drop that in the last. So it's going to be a particularly long show, this one, because each of those interviews are nearly an hour each. And we've got a lot of news to cover. Have you got some stuff you've seen on the net?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Yeah, one or two bits. The ladies' home in international, England versus Wales at Barston. Have you been keeping up with that
one? I have, yes. This is certainly the hot topic this week. We are a day or two late with this show, but I'm quite glad, because I wanted to see if we beat the Welsh or not. Being all patriotic.
Oh, we smashed it.
Yes, I noticed Bev Clifford and her partner as well absolutely smashed it. They were on Barston. It was an England international. International, yeah, like a home international, isn't it, when you do another great British country. But yeah, it was England ladies versus Wales ladies, and England won. It was a friendly, I believe, setting up something for the future, a future dynamic. But I'm really glad the event took place. I mean, it's Rob Hughes again, the driving force behind this, behind putting everything out there. The ladies all look really smart in the England uniforms, and it made me a bit envious. I'd love to represent the country.
Do you want to be a lady in an England uniform?
Yeah, I've saved my collection of red skirts for the occasion. No, but what I mean is, representing your country, lady or male, I think it's a big deal in whatever sport you can do that in. I mean, the nearest I came to was representing the county. I played for the county at cricket when I was a kid, and I also represented the county in the inter-county police matches, fishing matches that we had as a kid. And it's something I'm proud of now as a 40-odd-year-old. So to do that on a bigger scale, i.e. represent your country, fantastic. Absolutely fantastic, and we won. Not that it really matters. I think it's a good thing anyway. But nice to know we have some skilled lady anglers residing in our country.
Yeah, it'd be nice if it escalates this sort of thing with get some other nations involved in. Yeah, hopefully in the future, maybe a world champs.
Yep, and an over 40s. That's what we need. We need a seniors event. That's what we need.
You're pitching for yourself now, aren't you?
Obviously, yeah. I mean, you'll be able to get in a few years' time.
Over 40 now. But
when we went to Cromwell. I took my fantastic liquids that I got from DNA, the hydrolyzed wheat. Yes, I managed to blank. I don't blame Mark Holmes or the liquids, but I just might need some better application. Now the lake fish pretty moody, to be totally truthful. There were a few fish caught, but they were from the same part of the lake, and everyone else pretty much blank. Ironically, Sod's law of Sod, whatever you want to call it, the lake's fished pretty well since we left. There's been a fair few fish out. It's one of the ones that's not kicked properly yet. It's springtime, and I love this time of year when you see lakes switching on one by one. Generally, the bigger, deeper lakes are a week or two behind the shallower, smaller lakes. As it's all about water temperature this time of year, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, man. This lake in front of me, it's, for those who don't know, if you've not listened to me go on and on and on about it before, it's just shy of 200 acres. And, in the inaccurate test of sticking your hand in the water, it is certainly warming up. It's getting there. And, I've got a feeling. I'm actually getting confident as more as I sit here. The wind's dropped. It's a swim I've actually caught off the back of the wind before, which is pretty much what I am now. And I've either blanked in this swim or I've caught multiples, the least being four.
Well, hopefully you'll have four and you'll have some material for next week's show. Have you got any liquids or anything like that out there? Anything a bit different?
No, I've just got the dregs of what's in the bottom of my freezer, chucked it all in a bucket, splashed some hemp oil over it, give it a shake and spawned it out.
Well, hemp oil is liquid. You can buy hemp oil from DNA Baits, proud sponsor of the Carpcast, and we're very pleased to have them. They do some great stuff. If you ever listen to Mark Holmes's liquid talk, two Carpcasts ago now, and then have a look at the liquid section on the DNA Baits website, you'll be impressed at the price of the liquids are extremely well priced. On the low side, I was pleasantly surprised when I put my order in last week after Mark Holmes's talk. Excuse me. I do strongly advise you have a listen back to that one because it was pretty mind-blowing, I think. It was extremely interesting. Now, we know DNA do some fantastic boilies, including the Switch, which is the latest one out. They do a load of post-free deals. They do the Secret 7, which my pal Roger Bacon's been using all winter, had tons of fish on. The Nutter S, the SOK, the Ocean X. And they do post-free deals on all of those, and you can get a discount, an extra discount on the already great prices by using the code CARPCAST5 when you check out. So if you have a look at the website, if you buy any of the post-free deals or any of their products, any of the liquids, don't forget to use the code CARPCAST5 when you check out. You can get a 5-kilo deal. It comes 5-kilo boilies, 3-kilo of matching pellets or stick mix, a tub of pop-ups, tub of wafters, 250ml of bait soak delivered direct to your door for only $59.99, and that's before the 5% discount. 10 kilos is $94.99, 20 kilos is $149.99, and you can do that for any of the boilie flavours or recipes that we mentioned, and don't forget to look out for the Switch. They do Zig deals where you get like the Fox Zigger liners, their famous sticky sweet liquid, 2.5 kilo of spod mix, again post free, £30 delivered to your door. Do fluoro pop up deals where you get 5 tubs of fluoro pop ups, great for the single hook bait fishing this time of year. We discussed some of this with Mark as well in the interview coming up, the pH changes in the waters that Frank Warwick speaks about a lot. To be honest, every time I speak to somebody about bait, they're saying a lot of the same things now. I think we're getting to a point with carp that everybody seems in agreement. I mean, it's still a big science that we're unlocking the pieces to, you know, trying to find that wonder attractor, that wonder bait. But there's a lot of the same things keep coming up in these chats, starting off with the Frank Warwick single hook bait fishing stuff we spoke about on a few episodes ago. Mark Holmes is saying the same things. It's Mark Bryant on today's interview. Maybe from somebody who knows not a lot about bait, starting to come round to it. But I've always trusted, you know, the reputable bait companies. Obviously, Gary Bays has made all my bait for years, and he knows all about the science of it, and so does Jason and the rest of the DNA guys. I mean, they're experts in animal feeds and stuff, they own a very large animal feed company, which is where the hydro wheat and the other liquids come from. But I strongly advise checking out their website, dnabaits.com. And use the code CARPCAST5 when you check out as a way of supporting us and a way of supporting DNA for supporting us and keeping the CARPCAST going. www.dnabaits.com, CARPCAST5 at the checkout for your extra 5% discount, and check out their products. They're a fantastic company. Anything else on the net, Mark?
What else? Oh, yeah. Remember we mentioned a charity do the other week?
The Castaway Cancer one.
Yeah, that's the one. Just, you know, as a quick follow-up on that, you know, got to give them a big well done. They raised 21 grand for Macmillan Nurses. Now, that is a wedge and a half.
Wow, yes. Well done, guys. Well done to everybody involved in that. I'm glad we mentioned it. We chose them as our charity of the month.
Yeah, if anybody else has got an event they want us to mention, just drop us a line. Yeah. Give us the information, and once a month we'll give you a plug.
Yeah, we'll pick a worthy one. 21k for Macmillan. I mean, that is ridiculous. Their target was 15k, I believe, and they absolutely smashed it. And they would like all to thank all the people that helped them do that. Absolutely fantastic. I believe we've got a review, haven't we? We've got a true review.
True review.
We have. We've got a very true review. It's from Pinpoint Hooks. Now, we've both got a full set of their products that was kindly sent to us. Mine is... I'm not going to look for it, but it's around here somewhere, because I'll just start rustling and ruining the recording again.
Yeah, I've been using mine this week while I was away fishing as well. And I have to say, I was quite impressed with it.
Yeah, I am too, and yeah, we're going to have to review this without sounding like an advert, because I'm really liking the stuff as well. I mean, not only is a hook sharpening kit, but they have a hook sharpening service as well as their own next-gen hooks. And now, we each had a pack of twisters and chod twisters that had already sharpened up.
Yeah.
And my God, I was bleeding before I got one of the damn things out the packet.
Yeah.
They are silly sharp.
Yeah,
but we all know what an edge it can be.
In the pack you get two diamond files. They're pretty heavy duty ones. I mean, I showed the pack to one of my pals, and they said it looked cheap compared to the Jag stuff, and that's not... I mean, the Jag stuff's great. I've used the Jag stones and the Jag file, and I've got the little eyeglass thing and the hook clamp. I've used those for quite a few years now, and yeah, they are absolutely great. I personally preferred the Pinpoint stuff. They're a German company, aren't they?
The German. The website is pinpoint-hooks.de, which is D German Deutschland. But yeah, the files, they are quite large and quite wide.
Yeah,
which I quite like.
They're wide and they're quite heavy.
Slipping off and... Yeah, and you get, I say, you've mentioned the diamond files. There's one that's quite fine. And then you get a little stone file as well, just for finishing them off. There's a bit of grease if you want to protect the hook point, stop it rusting. There's little pens if you want to colour it up. And an eyepiece and a nice little tool case to keep it all in.
Yeah, and the eyepiece as well has got LEDs in it, which I noticed, which the Jag one doesn't. I don't know if they do that now.
I noticed that by accident and nearly blinded myself.
Yeah, I really like them. I can recommend them. I like the fact that the stone, I use the stones a lot for the Jaguans. Every time I recast out, you know, when your hooks have been overnight, I mean, they naturally kind of, it's actually corrosion, isn't it, that kind of blunt your hooks as they're in the water overnight.
Corrosion.
Just because...
oxidization.
Yeah, the hooks, the points round off. And I just use the stones to like touch them up before I cast out again, rather than have to file them again. I just use the stone. And the thing is with some of the stones that I've seen, the stones become really smooth very quickly. Now Jag one company that do stones, lots of companies do, I'm not singling out Jag as you know, that Jag have done the best stuff I've seen until I've seen this stuff, but the files, you know, they've got like some nicely molded with handles like stone files, and they don't last that long just because of the nature of a fine stone and you're filing metal with it, whereas these ones, they don't look fancy, these pinpoint hooks ones. They're just two big squares of or rectangular stones with like four usable sides on this stone, whereas the Jag ones are pretty thin, so you can just use the front and back, which means these are just naturally going to last way longer, and they're obviously quite a bit cheaper because they're just two kind of rectangular bits of stone, so you know, they're not flash, they're not fancy, but functional. You get 10 times the wear out of them than you do, especially as I use the stones a lot. I mean, a lot of people only use the files, and it probably doesn't affect them much if they don't use the stones, but I use the stones literally every time I cast out. You know, once I'm happy with the hook and it's filed to the thinness that I want it, then I just use the stones after that. And I've noticed with the Jag ones, I was forever buying them because they didn't seem to last that long. So this is a true review on Jag as well, I guess. But don't get me wrong, the Jag stuff's fantastic, I'm sure. You know, they're probably the best that I've seen in the UK, but this other company, they're German, they do supply to the UK, and I would check out their website, www.pinpoint-hooks.de. I can't say any more than that, it's a true review.
Yeah, I think we can slap a Carpcast endorsement on them, do you reckon?
Yeah, certainly, if you do sharpen hooks, it's very worth checking their stuff out. Like I say, the files are nice and thick. There's two types of pretty heavy duty diamond files that come with it, and obviously the stones, little vice. I have to say the Jag vice, probably easier to use, much more simpler, and a chunkier device to hold and stuff. I would say that the Jag vice has got the edge over the pinpoint hooks ones, but I think the rest of the kit, I would probably have the pinpoint hook stuff over the Jag stuff. But if I couldn't get the pinpoint hook stuff, I'd be very happy with the Jag stuff. There we go. It's a double true review, really, on both the stuff.
True review.
What else we got?
I don't know. We mentioned our social. Do you want to go a bit more in depth? Just talk about the captures and how things went down?
Yeah. So,
because there was a few carp caught.
It was the inaugural Carpcast social, which went relatively smoothly. We met everybody on the Friday. We had a draw for pegs. I completely gave everybody the wrong advice. The quarter of the lake that's got all the shallow bars, you know, the fish are always in at this time of year as the lake warms up. Didn't do a bite. In fact, the opposite end of the lake, the deep end where the wind was blowing and nobody was set up, the fish seemed to turn up in. They were showing fairly well down there. The Scottish outdid us, didn't they? The lad that was in
the first fish.
Yeah,
Peg 8, Andrew Taggart. He was got us off the mark with a 24 plus mirror, which delayed everyone's breakfast sandwich you're touching. What was it? It was about 9 o'clock on the Saturday morning, and the conditions, I'll be honest, they looked spot on. And I was just willing someone to catch, thinking, my God, these people, they've all come to fish with us, they've paid some good money, and I just so wanted people to catch, and it was a relief when someone did.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I hope everybody had a great weekend anyway. I'm pretty sure they did, you know, so hopefully everybody went away with something. It was a very good atmosphere, and it was a great group of lads, to be totally honest. But it was, like you say, a relief when Drew, Scottish Drew, caught a fish. It was good fish too. He had a fair few showing down there. I think he'd basically moved the rod after having fish showing all over him. He'd moved the rod to where one kept showing close in, and ended up catching one pretty soon after. And then that end of the lake, it did do a few fish after that, didn't it?
Yeah, Sean, who was on Windy Point, opposite. I mean, there was no one in, swim 11 to the left of him, and swim 11 commands a great big tree, which, well, for me and Sean, it just became known as the Tree of Life. Because it's one of those spots, as you know, it'll do nothing for weeks and weeks, and then someone will have a hit off it.
Yeah.
So with a few fish being down the end of the lake, I thought, it's got to be worth a bet for Sean to put a rod down there. So I commandeered bait boat, and... Yes, I was Captain Pugwash. I had to get instructions from you how to use it.
Yeah.
We went down there, took both of the bait out in Sean's rig. I'm sat with him. I'm showing him some zig setup that he was asking about. And literally 20 minutes after we've dropped the bait down there, his rod's curling round and he's into one.
Yeah.
That first one was, it was a mirror, a pretty little thing, about 13 pounds. Anyway, we finished the zig thing. You wanted the boat back round the other side after we'd got his bait back there. By this time, Jules had arrived, and before he did his talk in the evening, he's like walking round, he's spending time in everybody's swim. You know, he's brilliant at these events. He's an absolute star.
He is that.
He'd come round to see Sean. I left wheeling the bait back round the other side, and then Sean was in again. This one was a 22-pound mirror.
Yeah, it just goes to show how effective, especially those little, overhanging tree type spots, those real nooks and crannies. There's no doubt, like them or hate bait boats, they capture more fish in certain circumstances. So much to the point that I think you were considering going to the dark side, weren't you? You definitely saw the advantages of them.
Well, my plans of fishing has changed this year. My original plans was to play around on here and... have a go at Swan at Bluebell, but I'm fortunate as a syndicate I've been waiting for quite a while. I've been promoted, so I've got a place. So, I've spent my money on a ticket instead of a bait boat. So I've been saved from the day ticket madness of Swan. But I have seen, if I was going on Swan regular, then I'd have no hesitation in doing it. When in Rome, everyone else is doing it. Why should I, spam and get all my bait out there when I can just truck it backwards and forwards like everyone else?
Yeah, there's, love them or hate them, there's definite advantages to him, and I want to catch fish, and I don't want to make life hard. So, but anyway, let's not get down the bait boat debate.
There's no debate. I'm a convert. I've turned to the dark side.
And it was great. Julian went round, spent time in literally everybody's swim. He gave him a free copy of his latest book, Short Session Carp Fishing. He gave him all a signed copy in each swim. We gave everybody a goodie bag when they arrived anyway. We gave him a Carp Cast hat each, and some My Knowledge DVDs. And some
package of Jaffa cakes.
Jaffa cakes, of course. Yeah, it wouldn't be the same without the old Jaffas.
I had to drive down the A1 with a dozen packs of Jaffa cakes on the passenger seat next to me, and I couldn't touch any of them. It was the willpower that took.
I tell you, one of the highlights of the trip was the food. Fired up barbecues.
Oh yeah,
Richard did an amazing spread. It was not normal barbecue food. At all, there was like Moroccan lamb. It was really nice. Not like normal chicken wings, but like these big like spatchcock wings almost. It was just not a normal barbecue. It was absolutely amazing, and I strongly recommend, if you've got I know they cater for up to 250 people. They can do small events and big weddings and all sorts. I know he's quite busy throughout the year now, but. I cannot recommend strongly enough if you're going to hire in any sort of catering service. He does all sorts of stuff as well as barbecues. They do stuff all winter. They can do basically any sort of outside catering for any type of function. But the food was next level. I was really not expecting something that good. Fired Up Barbecues. There's links in the show notes on our Facebook page. There's all sorts of pictures of the spread that was laid on, and I think everybody went home fairly happy as far as their bellies are concerned.
No, oh, I certainly did. I don't think I'm wrong in saying that Richard, as well as being an absolute nice guy, he demonstrated the art of barbecue.
Without a doubt, you know, although, I was asking tips, how you get it going and burning evenly and types of fuel. It's like, you know, us guys have had a bit of barbecue experience in our time, but he made it look so easy.
Yeah. And, not always great, to be honest.
Yeah, man.
It has resulted in putting local vegetation out once or twice.
Yeah, pouring petrol on neat fires on pit two, if I remember. And yeah, we've had all sorts of disasters, haven't we, over the years. But yeah, his setup is amazing. The food was amazing. He really knows what he's doing. And if you are having any sort of event, then check him out, firedupbarbecues.co.uk. But we will put a link in there. In the show notes. Yeah, that was a Saturday night. We did the listeners' questions as well. We had a good old chat. Julian did a presentation about how he fishes, basically. Everything from him setting his rod up, from his line to his rigs, bait, everything. He went through it, and we did video it live. You can catch it on our Facebook page, and I've put an audio version of it up on the Carpcast Extra. If you're a Carpcast Extra subscriber, it's extra bonus content that you can get from our website, www.thecarpcast.com, where you can listen to all the back episodes of this podcast, or you can subscribe to support the show and get the extra content. And I said we would throw, as well as the monthly 3-hour special with all the celebs that we have, which is just all stories from famous people in the angling world, anything extra we get, you know, bonus content, we're going to throw that up there as well. And I've just sent Reese the file today, as it happens, of Julian's full hour and a quarter audio of basically how he fishes. And my God, the passion in his voice, it was unbelievable, wasn't it, Mark?
Oh, without doubt. And he makes so much sense. And what I enjoyed about it as well is just when he's talking about, like, you know, logical things like single bank sticks. You know, not only is it, you know, it's how he fishes, but it's how I fish as well. It kind of, like, you know, confirms my own things. It's like backs my thoughts up on certain things. And
yeah, make no mistake, you know, Julian's an extremely good angler. You know, he thinks about everything very similar way to I do, very logical. I just the things about the, you know, the fluorocarbon line, main line that he uses, feeling the bump, you know, the single bank sticks, the rig mechanics, just everything is exactly how I think. And, you know, utmost respect for Julian. There's no better ambassador for fishing, I think, than him. You know, he's been doing it a long time. He's got time for everybody. You know, he replies to all the letters and emails that he gets. He's always got time for people, and he's brilliant for the sport. And you can see that in this video. As I said, you can download the full audio version of it if you wish from thecarpcast.com if you are a subscriber. And what a top guy, and what a top talk on the Saturday. Sunday morning, we only had a few hours fishing. I think there was only one more fish out again. Sean again from the Tree of Life bagged another one. If he'd have had a bait boat in his swim, he'd have probably had 10 fish, I think, if he'd have had his own boat. You know, obviously, we were sharing a boat kindly lent to us by one of the other chaps, another Richard, I believe, on the trip. Thank you very much. It definitely helped Sean catch a few fish. But if he'd have had his own bait boat in there, like I say, he'd have probably had a good amount of fish, wouldn't he?
Yeah, without a doubt. And, there's no getting away from the fact that bait boats can be game changers.
Yeah, without doubt.
It certainly proved that way for Sean, and it put a smile on his face, and that was the target of the session.
Cool. What's in Carp Talk this week? We have an arrangement with Carp Talk where we're going to be doing a weekly article or a small piece in there, basically advertising the Carpcast, and in return we tell you what's going on in this week's edition of the Carpcast, probably the Bible of weekly carp fishing news. You can buy a digital version of it just to your app, your iPad. We know how people use their phone for pretty much everything now. You can get a digital version every Saturday for only £1.49, which is 3 days before the main printed version comes out. So if you're hungry to find out what's going on in the carp world, or you want to enter the competitions that they have every week, You can do that from pocketmags.com is where you get the digital version. You can download it to anything, your Apple Mac, your iPhone, Android, or PC. And obviously the normal print version comes out every single Tuesday. You can find out where to get that on the Carp Talk website. Or you can ask your local news agent to order it in for you. They will do that. But yeah, what's in this week's Carp Talk, Mark?
Well, if you look on the cover, there's a fish we've seen before. It's the one that Mark Holmes caught last year in the northeast, man. Les Marsh has banked it. Black spot from the Deepins. Lincolnshire record, 60 pound 5 ounce.
Wow, it's even bigger again. Yeah, I believe Kevin Nash's church pool has thrown up a big one as well. Full details.
It has.
Yeah, full details of that. I don't think those lakes have fished massively, have they? There's been fish caught since it's been open on the, you know, on the new system. It's just done its first big one, as far as we know. Something we spoke about on last week's Carpcast was Girton Pit in Nottinghamshire. They've just bought the Pendlefew Lancashire Three Big Fish. They speak to the owner of that venue all about it.
I've had a look at that article. You know, there were 240 mirrors and a £51 common.
What they purchased?
Yeah, obviously the big one is it Butthead, they call it? Or?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've had a few people messaging me about that. I mean, they're going into a big old lake, aren't they? We spoke about this last week briefly, didn't we? So we won't go into it again. But yeah, the full story is in this week's Carp Talk. If you want to know more about that, then grab the Carp Talk. There's the usual features in there. Roman Buksinski, somebody who's been around a long time, writing articles. There's a piece in there from him about his trip to the Rhône in France. Elliot Gray's got a load of tips in there about spring carp fishing. Mike Wilson talks about big carp culture. And there's Mark's weekly competition he's going to enter in there.
I've not entered a single one yet. I'm going to. But there's a load of LA Carp, which is a bait company. LA stands for Lone Angler. They've got lots of goodies to give away. And some Nash Siren R3 alarms. That competition continues.
Yep, there's loads of stuff in this week's Carp Talk. You can get the latest, you can get the digital version to your phone, app, iPad, whatever, from pocketmags.com or from Tuesday, which is tomorrow. You can purchase it in your shop. And it sounds like this week's episode is not to be missed. Now, we spoke about him before. We had a chat with Bait Guru, all-round nice guy, and somebody that's doing fantastic things for his local area, something we can all learn a lot from, was Baitworks' Mark Bryan. Feels like I'm in love. Just had the first time I met you. So I'd like to welcome Mr. Mark Bryant to the Carpcast. How are you doing?
I'm good, Jamie. Good.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to meet you. I think the last time I heard your name was when you had a bit of an accident last year. I remember seeing it in the press a bit, everybody wishing you well. You look fully recovered.
On the outside, I look fully recovered, but I'm still aching quite a bit, to be fair.
Do you have a lot of physio and stuff? And
yeah, I've had loads of physio, loads of stretching. It's been sort of a long haul back. A lot of work, but I'm sort of now sort of sat here. I'm probably about 90% back to full fitness, if you could call it full fitness, being a carp angler.
So for those that don't know, you were in a car crash and almost died, really. You're extremely lucky to still look as fit as you do and, you know, no lasting damage on the outside. I mean, you're in a coma, I believe you're induced, and a series of lucky events led to you still being sat here chatting on the Carpcast now.
Absolutely. I should have died that day. You know, that's a simple fact. If it wasn't for a string of coincidences happening as at the crash site, from the car going over and pinning me in such a way that stops my femur artery, which was severed at the time, from bleeding, profusely bleeding, which should have killed me in 10 minutes. to the air ambulance turning up just on time to give me blood transfusions, which saved my life. Three blood transfusions from crash site to hospital. So it's pretty amazing.
Three blood transfusions in there in the air ambulance. I mean, it's fantastic. We sometimes knock our services, you know, an air ambulance on site, and you know, some fantastic paramedics and doctors clearly saved your life, and you're back almost to fighting fitness. So we're glad you're here, obviously. And I think the water park is probably glad you're here. We're sat here in the beautiful Cotswolds, a place that I spent my teenage years, and inspired me to learn to drive many years ago. And I see you're originally from Bristol, but you obviously got inspired by the water park as well, did you? You live here now?
I did, you know, and no one can fail to see, you know, that there are massive blue, which is only sort of, I don't know, 60, 70 miles from Bristol. And that's such a lure, isn't it, for us carp anglers, and especially around the Bristol area. There's not many fisheries being clay based, being dug. So the natural progression was to get up here. And a friend of mine at the time, Jamie Woods, took me up to Hills, historic pit here on the Cotswolds, and to Coke's pit, and we even saw a couple of fish, and I was only sort of 16, 17 at the time, and that just lit the fire. So as soon as I could, I was up here dangling and getting dropped off my parents, and then getting a car, and I was up and fishing and exploring.
And you've also been doing some good for the water park as well. I noticed that you've been hosting some shows or social evenings and giving all the money to sort of local clubs to keep it going. I mean, you don't often find that in areas. I mean, you've obviously moved to the Cotswolds, you've made this place your home, and putting back into the lakes and the community by the look of it as well.
Yeah, I think it's really important. You know, when I moved up to the Cotswold Water Park, what struck me straight away was the open access waters where anyone can fish. There aren't that many, and they're pretty much run by two big clubs on the water park, South Sydney Angling Club and Ashton Keynes. Ashton Keynes Angling Club in particular are run by a group of anglers, a lot of volunteers that can get paid to do it, and a lot of the lakes they have are leased. So that brings problems in that, you know, you see some of the are year-to-year lease, some of them a bit longer term. So the club doesn't make that much money, so they didn't have a lot of money to invest into fish, and especially on their more short-term leases. So I saw an opportunity up here to bring everyone together, because I used to love the carp site events, you know, the old regional meetings, and I really missed them when they sort of fizzled out, and to bring that back up to the Cotswold area, I thought was really important. Just bring a lot of good people together and good things happen. So the idea was born to bring in a speaker to attract a lot of people through the door, to pay on the door, and we got get supported very well by a lot of different tackle companies, which is growing, and they give to the raffle, and we raise almost as much on the raffle as we do on the door now, which is great. And what I thought was, you know, it's great to give to, you know, cancer research and all, but the anglers, we should help ourselves first and foremost. And I saw the opportunity up here to supply either money or in the way of fish. I thought, what a lovely idea to have an event to raise £2,000-£3,000 and go out and buy fish and say to Ashton Keynes Angling Club or the Carp Society or South Cerny Angling Club, here's 50 fish, here's 20 fish to go and stock at your lakes at what you will. They all come from a good source. They're all pedigree fish. They're all going to grow massive up here. And so far we've done that. We've managed to stock, proud to say, over 125 carp now over the last 5 years, which is the future of the park.
I did. I've got a similar story. We run the Northern Angling Show now, but the Northern Angling Show started with exactly the same type of event, 300 people in a hotel in Altrincham near Manchester. Myself and a chap called Roger Bacon, we did the first one for the Trinity Hospice, because his daughter had leukemia, and she sadly died, and we gave the money to the hospice and everything. But they said to us, when we were all proud of ourselves handing over a cheque for like £3,500, same thing, the raffle made more than the door. Mm. And they basically said, because it's such an emotive subject, children dying, people are throwing themselves up at us to give us money. We're not short on money. You're better off giving it something else. So we did give it to them, but the second year we did it, we stocked lakes in the local area. It's exactly the same story. We bought a fish for a lake that Roger now runs. It was council-owned at the time, but a lake known as Deadman's. It's done some decent fish. It's had three stockings since, but those original stockies are all sort of upper 20s now. Hoping to see the first 30 this year. But yeah, we went down exactly the same route. We did do the charity one first and then fish. Years later, that turned into the Northern Angling Show now, which is, like I say, had 10,000 people this year. But it's great to see someone else has done something, you know, in an area. It'd be nice if there was somebody in every area in the country, every sort of county that were, you know, looking after the local area, because us anglers, we like going to these shows, don't we? We want to hear Dave Lane talk, or Terry Hearn, or Terry Dempsey, or
absolutely. You know. I think, you know, it can be rolled out anywhere. As you know, down in Devon, they've had problems with predation down there with the otter situation, which is nationwide now. And it doesn't take a lot, just a bit of hard work, just to get people together, get a speaker, hire a pub, whatever it is, and all the money you raise on a night goes back into fish. It's just such a great thing to put it back into something that's hopefully going to be around for sort of 30, 40 years.
Yeah, there is a gap, like you said, with the Carp Society fizzling out, and you know the regional meetings were fairly legendary. I mean, I was a member of the CAA when that first started, the Carp Society again. You know, I joined the Carp Society. I had to join the Carp Society to fish Horseshoe the year they raised the money for the pledges. I moved away from the area then, but there is a gap. I mean, have you been following the Carp Society story recently? I have, yes.
It's just, as you say, such a shame from what it started out and what it was to what it is now. I'm sure it'll come out in the wash. It always does. But it's just what a great opportunity there was there to do something really good for carp fishing and to stand together, and it's just so fragmented now. It's a shame. It's a shame there's not one unifying organisation to speak for us all.
And would you be disappointed if Horseshoe got sold, and you know, a group of people that were not involved in the Carp Society in its inception or in its heyday profited from that? Is something that sits as bad with you as it does with me?
It does, absolutely. And if that happens, well, you know, I hope it doesn't. There's legal people I know involved with the situation at the moment, and I just hope that, you know, it gets resolved and you can sort of move on from it, because it's just it makes me sick, you know.
I think people became apathetic to the Carp Society. I mean, pre all this recent scandal, I mean, the regional meetings fizzled out because they got a little bit tired, and maybe if we can sort this mess out now, and we get people like yourself, you know, representatives, people who are interested in the community in each area, maybe we can start the regional things up again. You know, instead of doing, you know, a private event, it can be under the banner of the Carp Society with support from, you know, their network.
Absolutely. You know, the Carp Society, it inspired me as a youngster. Well, I used to go to the Carp Society meetings when I was sort of 15, 16, got dropped off there, and they were just brilliant. You know, I was in awe of them. And that inspired me to want to work within the angling trade. It inspired me to fish and to carry that pursuit on. And at the moment, there's no direction, I suppose, for the younger kids coming through. Those meetings are brilliant. They're great grounding for me. It's fantastic.
My thoughts exactly. I remember applying to the Carp Society in a big long letter with a list of all the fish I'd caught that year. You know, and it was something you wanted to join. I wanted to be part of a club in the sport that I was passionate about, and you know, in the hobby. And there is nothing. I mean, if you're a 14-year-old kid like I was then, I mean, and you love carp fishing, I mean, what do you do? Like, there's nothing, is there? I mean, all right, we got a magazine every 6 months and a badge or something to pin on a hat or whatever. But you were part of something. You belonged to a community, a group. And I remember meeting Baz Griffiths, who was involved with the junior fishings then. And I met him on a lake in Lower Tamar, you maybe know, in Devon.
Yeah.
He used to fish there as a kid when, because they had no close season. So we used to go there for the Easter holidays every year and used to fish on the lake. And Baz Griffiths was in the next peg, and they ended up becoming friends. And he volunteered to come and pick. Sorry, I got a frog in my throat. He volunteered to come and pick me up for the horseshoe fishing.
Right.
obviously fantastic, you know, a virtual complete stranger, a lovely guy, and that's what the Carp site was about then. It was about doing stuff for the young'uns. I think that's about the only thing they still do, isn't it? They still have a junior fishing, don't they?
Which they have to pay a pretty penny for now, I think.
I don't think we had to pay then. I mean, Baz offered to pick me up from a house, which was in Shipston-on-Stour, pick me up from the house, drive me to Lechlade, take me for the weekend and bring me home again. And that was, you know, diverting from Birmingham, which is where we lived, I think.
Yeah.
And now, yeah, it's probably hundreds of pounds, I would guess, too.
It is, yeah. And I like to think I was a product of the Carp Society Junior Fishings as well. I went on about three. And a great guy called Alan Atkins, who now lives in France. He used to run them, absolutely top fella. And they were just, you know, to go on those weekends away fishing, it was just the whole, that was my whole world just there in 24 hours, 48 hours, amazing. It's a shame that, yeah, nothing really has took the mantle on, I suppose. And I'd love to see the Carp sort of come back in some form or another, because I think everyone's waiting for something like that.
Yeah, like you say, I mean, it's the youth. I mean, you know, would I join a new group? I mean, if there was some sort of political benefit, you know, if we were going to lobby the government for, you know, the strength in numbers thing, the otters are a big problem now, and the only way you're going to get a voice heard is by being unified, is having a group. And I know the Predation Action Group have been attempting to do stuff recently. I speak to Rob Hughes a lot, who will be listening to this. He's a fan of the show and appears regularly. I know he's been working behind the scenes with various people about this, but you know how it works with governments and stuff. Unless there's a big group of people, there has to be a certain amount of people for them to take notice. And, you know, the Carp Society's got, what, maybe 20-odd members. There's maybe another 50 that have applied this year to try and do something about the current situation. But, I mean, there were hundreds, if not thousands, back in the day, wasn't there?
There was, and there should be someone unifying body where all carp anglers, they join, and it's, even if it's free, who cares? It's all anglers under one banner, and I say, when you go to Parliament, or if you want to get anything done in this country, you need numbers, you need volume behind it.
Yeah.
All these fragmented groups are great. Don't get me wrong, the Predation Group, and there's sterling work that's going on, but we do need to unify everyone together somehow.
And obviously you're heavily involved in the water park. That has a big problem with otters currently. I mean, give us the timeline of that. When did you first started noticing? Were lakes hit? Have any lakes been absolutely wiped out? I mean, how's it affected the area?
Massively, in a word. So the water park's always had otters. So, you know, even back Ashley Pool, people remember that lake. That's been wiped out on a couple of occasions now. And that's going back sort of 20, 25 years ago now.
Yeah.
Even longer, actually. So they've always been here. But we really started to see some momentum about sort of 5 years ago. And that coincided with lots of them being spotted in and around the water park on the Spine Road. They're being run over, being spotted in lakes, and without accusing, or, you know, it's almost like a percentage have been released. Can't say that for true.
The government deny this, don't they? They deny that otters have been released in the last 10 years, and so many areas have reported exactly what you've said. The last 5 or 6 years, you know, they've come from nowhere.
Yeah.
And they're denying that any have been released at all.
Yeah, they have a momentum, and certainly 5 years ago, that was when we started really, you know, seeing them, and they were sort of stumbling onto roads, a little bit naive and getting killed, and there was lots of dead otters around. And from then, but there's always been otters up here, let's make that clear. But they're doing very well, and that's the part of the problem. The Cotswold Water Park, over 130 lakes here, loads and loads of water, streams, wildlife, sanctuaries. So they're doing well and they're multiplying, and now we're starting to see them on lots of the fishing lakes here, especially not only the highly stocked ones, even the low stock. And it's a really, really worrying time for a lot of these clubs that I've even mentioned. I'll give you an example. Ashton Keane's Angling Club, they lease a lot of their lakes. So they're always tentative about sort of putting fish in or putting money into fish, because they don't know in 2 years, 3 years' time that lease could be pulled. So a lot of the fish that are here on the water park have grown big over 20 years, say, 15, 20 years. And a lake down the road, literally probably 3 miles from here, was the jewel in the crown for Ashton Keane's Angling Club. And at a time, it used to have four forties in there on a club ticket for like 60, 70 quid, which is gold dust, and get people travelling, and it propped up the membership for the club. The club, you know, they'd have sort of 300 plus members, and a lot of them were to fish this lake, you know?
Yeah.
Not have 300 members fishing at one time, but they would buy the ticket and join because of those fish. Well, that lake now has pretty much been wiped out over the last three seasons, three winters by otters.
Wow.
They decimated it in the winter. They took all the tops, as you know, they go in, they take generally the biggest, slowest fish, generally your big females. So the top set has literally been taken out. And of course now, the set below that are mid-30s or 30 pounds. There was only 19 carp or so, 19, 20 carp in there.
Yeah.
Mirrors. And now, potentially, you know, it's down to probably single figures, and who knows if there's any of the big ones left, but certainly three out of the four have died, gone.
It's a shame, isn't it? There's something about it. I mean, when you target carp, you know, any members that are fishing that lake, you become invested in a water, don't you, anyway? Yeah. But, you know, even if you don't own the water, if you fish it, you put time in, you're wanting to catch that A team and all the others along the way. And if they get taken away from you like that, like kind of unjustly taken away, it's not like they died of natural causes or anything. It's I don't know, I mean, it that's the word I'm looking for, it resonates with people, you know. And there is no angler now that's not aware of this otter situation, but obviously we have to do something. I mean, have you discussed, you know, some of your yearly meetings? Fence it. Is it too impractical to fence a lot of the lakes, or can we raise money for that?
Yeah, it depends on the lake. You know, we've given money to fish in the past, and last year, not this winter, just gone, the winter before, we actually bought a temporary electric fence, which is a three-string electric fence from a company called Rapper Fencing. Brilliant bit of kit. You can fence up to like 1,500 metres. It's amazing. Right. So it goes around a big lake, 5-acre lake, you know, and you can get two of them if you want to join up to do complete circuit. And that cost about $1,000. So we put money aside to buy that, and we've actually loaned that system out to a club on the water park this year, and they've borrowed that for this winter, and it's, so far, fingers crossed, here we are into April and they haven't had a problem, or the problem they had in December, they put this fence up and they haven't had a problem since. So there are solutions out there, and if you can fence, I think you know, you have to fence, you just have to, and there are ways of doing that. There's, you know, the Embryo organization are doing great work now, and in terms of the cost per meter, I'm getting quotes for like £12 a meter to fence. So on some lakes, you know, so if it's 1,000 meters, if it's 2,000 meters, it's achievable. And all it takes is, you know, people getting together and to raise money, either within the club or outside the club, or ticket prices go up by 20 quid, 30 quid, whatever it may be, by hook or by crook, get the money and get the fence done.
So you talk about the Embryo project, that's something that Danny Fairbrass and Corda started. You've been a consultant with Corda for a number of years now, have you?
Yeah, about 4 years, I think, four or five years.
Have you spoke with him or spoke with Corda about the otter fencing and stuff? Are you involved with that side of it?
I have. I've talked to Danny. I've talked to a guy called Matt Petit, who runs the Embryo side, and he's actually come down to the water park to see what we've done here. I'm lucky enough to be involved and run a few fisheries here. We've actually fenced our lake, you know, this, and the lake that we fenced was 10 acres in size. The owner basically leased the rights off to fish it, so the owner didn't want to put money in. So I was in a real hard place. What do I do? You know, it's a 10-acre lake. The otters are going to be coming in. I've got to do something. So we basically raised the money between sort of 32 members, and we had work parties, and we hand dug every fence pole. It took like bloody a year and a half to do, but we done it.
You did it yourselves.
And we done it on a budget, and we must have done it for about $3,000 or $4,000, which is unheard of, really. We had a lot of help with materials, and you put the word out there and you'll be amazed. Oh, my mate works on a site. There's a load of reclaimed posts. Oh, you know, you can get 50 for nothing. Like, you know, just come and pick them up. Or there might be some old fencing or hard, you know, wired. There's lots of, you know, as soon as you open up that communication and start talking to people, you get a lot of good people together, good things happen. I'm a strong believer in that. So to answer your question, any lake around the water park can be fenced. to a degree. It just depends on access, the ownership of it, and those factors as well. But there's always, in my experience, there's always a solution for every lake.
Yeah, I mean, there'd be people listening to this that think that haven't been affected by otters yet, and it's a matter of time. You know, the way lakes are having problems there. I mean, I think at some point, we've covered it on the show before, but there's been a test case recently. I don't know if you heard about it. I think it was the something to do with the Gamekeeping Society. Right. And they've won a test case that was being defended by the same argument that they use against us fishermen being able to get licenses to control them.
Right.
And anyway, the National Gamekeepers Union basically won this case in court, which is, it directly affects angling, so much so that the Angling Trust are now currently drawing up some sort of license application set up based off this test case. So we're looking to kill time, really, until we can legally control them, I guess.
I think that's a long time off. You know, our government wheels turn very, yeah, very slowly. And I hope there's something on the horizon. I don't know how long that's going to be, but the danger is, and the danger for locally here on the water park and other waters around the country, is it would be too late anyway.
Yeah, so it's immediate, isn't it? We can see, you know, the lake we're sat on now has had otters here this winter. I witnessed one myself, and it doesn't take long, does it, for a family of otters to make a serious impact on any stock of fish, does it?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. They're working their way from the latter end of the water park now, and they've literally decimated three or four lakes, and as they're breeding, they're pushing their young out after a year or 2 years, and they're now finding their own food sources, and it's plentiful, and that's the problem we've got up here, isn't there? There's plenty of lakes.
Yeah, it's a lot of food for them, isn't it? Mm. It's a kid in a sweet shop. So I like the idea of that electric fencing as a kind of a short-term fix, and but I mean, it's, you know, what do you say? It was 130 lakes on the water park.
Yeah, it's 130 lakes and growing.
And some of them are huge.
Some of them are massive, and that's what. And some of them potentially are unrealistic. Some of the big lakes, anyway, are low stock densities, and although obviously the otters are not selective, they are targeting some of the smaller lakes next to the water courses, the easy pickings, and you'd hope that the big wilder lakes. Obviously, they got to run the gauntlet there, but in terms of an otter hunting or predating a certain lake, then they want the best return they can for their hunting. And yeah, we only, you know, as well, this goes quiet. The problem with the water park, as this is nationwide, it'll go quiet. So if you go into April, May, the otter's diet is varied. They're taking bird eggs, they're eating crayfish, and They do target fish to some degree on some lakes. They especially there's a plentiful supply, but on the whole, generally the water park's very quiet up until about sort of end of November, and it usually coincides with obviously high rainfall, or it goes very, very cold, and then suddenly all the rivers are in flood. The otters can't hunt very efficiently in flowing water because they're losing body heat very much, much more quickly than they would in still waters, so they're forced to come into still waters. And that's when they're coming in and hunting. This is, you know, if you look at all the otter kills on the water park, most of them are from November up until probably about this week, and then it changes.
And with carp being cold-blooded, they're slowing down in the winter. As soon as that water temperature drops, they're easier targets again, aren't they?
Unfortunately, yeah. Especially the bigger fish, especially the females, they're sat laid up somewhere. Otter comes in, thank you very much, I'll be back next night as well, and next night as well.
Yeah.
And it can happen very, very quickly, and the worrying stat that I also remember is I talked to Mark Simmons, and he said you only find 10% of what's being taken, and I think a statistic that I'd go along with as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not good news, but on a brighter note, there's a lot of fish around here. The area, size-wise and stuff, it does seem to be thriving at the minute. I mean, you know, I spent a lot of time around here as a teenager, and the main thing I've noticed the difference is great big houses on all these lakes now. I mean, how does that sit with you, with the kind of commercialisation of all these holiday homes and proper houses?
I think it's inevitable, really, with, you know, the expanse of water up here, and the water park is actually split into a few different jurisdictions with councils, and you notice, like, up the east side of the water park, there's a lot of where we're sat now, there's lots of houses and development going on. And those lakes got snapped up very early on, which is good and bad in a way. Bad for the fishing generally, unless you've got £1 million to spare. I think, well, a bit more bait before I even contemplate anything like that. But yeah, so the lakes are sort of taken up with houses, and the fishing is very much, you know, it pales into insignificance when they're dealing with that sort of money. So although the water park has got hundreds of lakes on it, almost, you know, 130 plus, there's actually very few which are open access where you can actually go and fish. And that's why it's very important that these clubs and organisations survive. And obviously with the fish, and yeah, the more fish that go in, the better, really, because for every one we're putting in, there's one being taken every winter or more. Yeah.
So you briefly mentioned the bait company there. You're known for Baitworks, which is a company I didn't know much about other than seeing the logo. You've got a hoodie on now with the, what is it? It's like a cog. Yeah. It's synonymous with quality. I see it spoken about extremely highly. We've had a few bait gurus on this podcast, so I want to pick your brain a little bit about that sort of stuff. So first of all, I mean, how long have you had the company, and what made you start making your own bait?
So I've been making bait pretty much on and off all my life. You started in my mum and dad's kitchen, as a lot of people, a lot of guys probably resonate with, mixing paste and flours and vanilla essences and all sorts of making a right mess. And sort of progressed from there, from making bits of bait. And I was always fascinated in terms of why something worked. I noticed some flavours or some ingredients were, I was getting more bites, albeit at sort of local day ticket lakes in Bristol and that. So I've always sort of made bait on and off. And it wasn't until I got to sort of my late 20s, I suppose, I was playing football, and I retired at the ripe old age of 29, being a 5'9" goalkeeper. I was always limited in terms of how far I was going to actually make it. I always turned my attention, my love for fishing has never changed, and I've always wanted to work within the angling industry. And I was supplying baits locally, and it just sort of, it was a natural progression. It sort of grew from there. And as soon as I saw the opportunity to move the business up to the Cotswold Waterpark where we are now, I was quite lucky in the fact that there wasn't very many other, or hardly any bait companies up here. So it managed to get up here, and I managed then to make baits and supply a lot of local anglers in the area. And that really had built the foundations of the company. And from then we've just organically grown over 10 years full time, 11 years when I started the company. And now we've got a factory just literally 4 miles from where we're sat now.
So you've got the fishing, the factory, the work, you've got everything on the doorstep. And do you roll your own bait? Have you got the machines?
Yeah, that's one thing I've been very particular about since I started the company, was to invest back into machinery, to do everything in-house. I didn't like the idea of shipping the bait off to be contract rolled. And to be fair, as a small company, I couldn't afford to do it anyway. You know, that's a big part of the profit. So from day one, literally everything has gone back in, so much so that me and my girlfriend, she actually met me just before I started the bait company. We didn't go on holiday together for the first sort of 8 years, which she keeps reminding me of now. And so because that money will go back into a Hobart or a mixer, or there's always something else to buy. You know, that's always the case. Even now, there's something else to buy. But I'm very particular about doing everything in-house and having complete control over everything, ingredients, machinery. So we're when we do get busy, it's all in our control. We haven't got to rely on anyone else.
What does it annoy you when you get field tested? They want an odd size bait or something, or when is it? I don't know much about bait rolling, but I know when I've been with Nash Bait for like 12, 13 years, and I say to Gary, I want this, you know,
I want a 12 mil or a 10 mil or something.
Something a bit different, and that's a big outlay just to do something slightly different.
It is, yeah. The scale of our sort of rollers now, then, yeah, it'd be a bit of investment to do different sizes. But, you know, to be fair, 15s and 18 mils are pretty much standard for most companies.
Yeah.
I would like to bring in a 22 and a small, tiny roll, like a 10 mil. And I think that's on the horizon. We are looking to do that. But yeah, you do get a lot of requests, but it's just not feasible sometimes on production runs. It's to, you know, you need to supply those two core sizes, and we try and cater for everything, but trying to especially the 10 mils. Christ, they are nightmare.
how, from somebody who doesn't understand much about bait other than trusting people that do, I mean, how far have you gone into the science of bait, of carp's diets, what they need, the attraction?
Yeah, well, I think it's a good point. Most, I think all companies really should have a knowledge, a background, or a professor sort of be learning about the nutritional requirements of fish. Is something I've put a great emphasis on. I think if we're going to stick a hook in them, yeah, we want them to repair. So in terms of matching the carp's diet, matching their requirements, and also obviously the attraction element is absolutely key and important.
Yeah.
And we've got sort of the guys like Simon Scott, I know, has been on your show. Simon Scott's involved with the company, has been for the last five, six years. So he has an involvement with the makeup of the baits ongoing as well.
Yeah.
But I think we're obligated to say to give back to the carp at the end of the day. So we're putting them through a lot of stress, and they need to repair. And, you know, so I put great emphasis on protein, digestible protein as well, and what protein content you're putting into the bait, and what protein source as well. And I think it's coming in the bait industry in terms of stickers on bags and disclosing what we're using, and I think it's a good thing. We've always listed ingredients on our websites, and so people can have got an idea or an understanding of what goes in the bait. But there seems to be a lot of bait companies at the moment who either put a sticker on a bag and ship it out, and they're getting it contract bowled by another company, and it's not regulated, is it? So
I've heard it's not regulated, and at the end of the day, it's animal feed. I mean, we are, and it's not any old animal. I mean, these fish are worth a lot of money.
Yes.
You know, you think how much a £30 or a £40 carp is worth, and you can feed them on anything. Things that are really not good for them. I've heard horror stories about, you know, companies just repackaging stuff and whacking it out and having no control over what's in the bag, and you know, you don't know how, you know, there are unscrupulous people that are just after profit, after money, you know, and who knows what's in some of these bags. But I have heard horror stories of glass and sawdust and wood chippings and
sweepings off the floor. And
exactly, yeah. And you know, if you're buying it off somebody else for £1 a kilo, slapping a sticker on it and selling it for £5 a kilo or something, you know, it's I can guarantee it's probably not something of high quality in that bag, is it?
People need to sort of make an informed, giving the people making an informed decision based on what they're using, what company, to do a bit of homework. Because I can guarantee you, you know, we get, the phone goes red hot this time of year, like any bait company, and the first question is, it's not what's in the bait, it's how much is the bait.
Yeah.
And that needs to change, really. Because they don't care, really. They just, you know, if it's cheap enough bait, oh, yeah, happy days, and I'll get 10 kilos or whatever. But I think it's a good thing if the bait industry, it has some legislation on it, because there is none at the moment, and it means that I could put, you know, I could say there's gold dust in the bait and there's no one there to stop me.
Yeah, I mean, that is an issue, especially as we are feeding animals. I believe there is some sort of EU law that's potentially going to cover this.
Yeah.
I know some bait companies do already print, you know, what's in it, and it's no big secret about what's in a lot of baits. You can have stuff tested, but generally it's the inclusion rates, you know, it's your ratios and stuff that are the key things to making something successful.
That's
so
right, yeah.
So I think it's obviously correct that we should be printing on the bags.
I think it would be good, and especially not that the industry needs a clear out, but there's a lot of small bait companies, and don't get me wrong, I was a small bait company. I still class myself as a small bait company, but I had to start somewhere, and you gradually go up the runs. But I feel like we've done it in a way we've organically grown, where a lot of companies are making calls to other bait companies who are buying in something on a Tuesday, frozen, comes through the post, put a sticker on it, goes out to an unsuspecting customer. And I think, you know, for me, that's eating away at the guys who are trying to do it properly.
Is that quite common, would you say? I mean, how often does that
very
happen?
Very common.
Wow.
Very common. We get asked a lot. We got rang up by other bait companies to produce their baits for them.
Really?
And not just, you know, contract rolling is a different thing. If, you know, to contract roll something, if they send the base mix over, that's fine. We can do that. But, you'd be surprised how many players in the industry actually buying a pre-rolled, pre-made bait. There's a lot, hell of a lot.
Wow, and I suspect these companies that are contacting you are probably saying the cheapest bait you can possibly give us.
Exactly, it doesn't cut, it always cut, yeah, exactly. The first question is cost.
Yeah, Very interesting. Do you do any sort of baits that are specifically for fish growth for stock? You know, let's say I had a lake and I want to buy a nutritional board. It doesn't have to be particularly attractive. Just a food bait that's never going to get fished. Do you have a product like that that's lake owners can buy?
Well, we have throughout the range. We have sort of the Atlantic Heat and the Roar Marine. The Atlantic Heat is the first bait that we released, and that ticks nutritional wise the carp's diet. It's about 35% sort of protein level, so it's not excessive, and very attractive. And the fish weights, not only in the lakes around here, have done superbly well when it's been introduced en masse to the lakes. Interestingly, we've been asked by a number of lakes to produce a feed boilie, which is quite interesting. So no flavour profile, nothing like it. Just literally.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking, really. Yeah. The feed boilie. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a few fisheries that have asked us to do it. It's something we're sort of exploring because they're feeding their lakes with pellets and wheat and all sorts, but they want that package basically into a boilie that withstands the nuisance fish like the roach or the birds and doesn't get pecked away and stays intact for long periods.
Yeah.
So we're looking into that. It's just trying to make it cost effective because you've got a rolling charge on it. You've obviously got to bind it together and it's got to stay intact. And then obviously you've got the actual bait, which costs money itself. So we're looking at potential cereal based bait, which it's not going to be a complete diet for the carp, but it's going to be a supplementary part of their diet. Yeah. So that's something we're quite interested in and sort of looking into at the moment.
So when you say cereal, I mean, I've heard of a lot of lakes feeding wheat and stuff for carp. I mean, I don't know anything about how much goodness wheat can do and other cereals for carp, but I mean, you know, can they sustain a diet of stuff like that?
If it's just purely, if they were in a tank and you fed them just wheat, then no. But because they're out in a lake and they've got a very varied diet, and they say it's a supplement too. Yeah. You know, a lot of the fish farmers are feeding wheat over in France. Fish farmers in the UK feed about 30% wheat to 70% pellet.
Right.
So it's a good ingredient. It's, you know, it's obviously very cheap as well. 11-12% sort of protein content, so the fish do get a benefit from it. Same with like micronized barley, a lot of the other cereal, flake maize, really good. If you're supplementing that and putting that into a fishery, it's going to be beneficial, absolutely.
So you're looking at making a boilie with that as a base.
Yeah,
and then obviously the missing bits as well.
Yeah, it's I say you're never going to create a complete diet from sort of the cereal based. You're going to be limited in sort of the amino acid sort of count for the carp. You're going to be deficient in quite a few areas there. You look at sort of scretins; they're still using marine derived proteins at the moment, be it from fish meal. For a complete diet for carp and obviously all their other fish that they supply. Interestingly, they did make an announcement a couple of weeks ago that they're announcing that they've found the first sort of vegetable sort of cereal based diet, and they think they're going to roll that out in the future
in their pellets.
So they're switch. That's the first time I've ever heard that. And you've got to look at someone like Scretton's because they are a multi-million pound company. The amount of research that goes into it is absolutely huge. So they're starting to sort of look at other alternatives, which is interesting for obviously the bait industry, because we're always looking at what they do as well, because the fish, the fish meal prices, as we all know, are only going to go one way. And we all need to be looking at sort of alternatives and sustainable products.
It sounds like the fish eat better than us, you know. We get £1.50 convenience meals, you know. Some people live on in shops, and there's a lot of attention. So, I mean, what is the perfect attraction diet for a fish? Do you believe that if fish get everything they need? I mean, if humans were to eat the perfect diet to make us healthy, it's probably not the stuff we actually fancy, is it?
It's an interesting question, actually, because there's a chain of thought to say that there's nutritional recognition through carp, and they can tell what's good for them. And I think with wild animals, that does hold weight. So, and for myself, I like to design baits around that theory anyway, but I put a great emphasis on taste and attraction as well. So you've got to have the two married together to give yourself not just a good bait, a great bait. So I was quite fortunate growing up in Bristol. I had lots of... I've kept koi all my life, and my parents have as well. So I was always dropping bits and pieces in tanks. You can get a very good base reading. It's not an absolute, because I think it's dangerous to try, you know, to try and pigeonhole something just from what you've seen in the tank. But you can certainly find out what's a good ingredient or a mediocre ingredient and what's a great ingredient. But what it also does, it can cancel out a lot of stuff as well.
Yeah.
So what all the hearsay on some ingredients being an X1 ingredient, you can drop it into a tank and see what the fish's reaction or if there's no reaction. So that is, you know, that's something I've carried that through till today. We've now, luckily with Simon involved, we've got access to the Sparshalt tanks, and Simon keeps fish himself, so we can do more manner of tests and very quickly find out about all manner of things.
I didn't realise, Simon, I've seen him mention Baitworks, I didn't realise he was involved with the company to the level that he is. I mean, that guy's not much he doesn't know about carp, is
there? Yeah, he's a great, as you know, Simon, he's straight down the line, a really honest guy, and it was ironic, he used to conduct the carpology tank tests, and this was five or six years ago now. So he started off, and basically a company let him down. They're supposed to send him a load of baits and they let him down. So Simon fishes up locally around this area anyway. So one of Simon's friends tipped me off and said, "Oh, Mark, do you fancy going on for the carpology tank test?" And I was like, I just started the company pretty much only like a few years in. I goes, "Yeah, no problem." He said, "Right, send this bait to this address." And so I just sent off a load of our bait to Simon down in Winchester. He then took it into the carpology. He's done the tank test at Sparshalt, and then obviously done the R2 in carpology. And our baits, I believe still to this day, got the highest marks across the all three, which was brilliant for myself. And he didn't know me from Adam, so I've never advertised with carpology. So there's no, you know, nothing going on there. It was just literally, there was the results. And he was so impressed with the results that he got in contact with me and just sort of just asked about the baits. And of course, I sort of got to talk with him because he was local up here fishing. And we just become friends. And after about a year or so, it became a more, I don't say a permanent thing, because we're just friends, like, and he just uses my bait. But I've got him involved more and more because of his background with the fishing side of things. And he runs his own fish farm. We talk quite heavily about sort of what, you know, goes on nutritionally in the darts, what he's doing in there, and obviously that carries over to naturally into the bait. So it's great to have someone like that on board.
Do you think there'll ever be one attractor that carp just can't that's almost cheating, they're just going to make a beeline for it? Have you ever come across anything like that when you first introduce it and they just crazy?
To answer the first, I hope so. I hope there is a golden one, because that's what we're all searching for at the end of the day. I think there's a lot of ingredients that I've tested that have been absolutely, you know, gold winners, like, you know, and a lot of them do have a common theme that you need to take it back. I think what people miss is actually look at the carp, study the carp, and see what can they actually detect. And once you look at those, because they're very simple creatures in terms of, you know, their brains are the size of a 15 miller, you know, they're very, very simple creatures, and they are hardwired in certain areas to pick up certain substances within the water column. First of all, it needs to be soluble, and they're hardwired to detect breaking down and small chain amino acids.
Yeah.
So the more we can put that into our baits, the more we're hitting the attraction. And it's no coincidence that a lot of the very successful ingredients out there, like some of your Marmites, your Belachan, all-time classic, it's a naturally fermented product. The protein chains have been broken down, and they're called free aminos. That's what's attracted to fish. That's what they can detect. That really flicks their switch, and they're hardwired. And what that means is when they come over a baited area, if that flicks their switch, which it should do, those what I've just talked about, they're in no doubt that's food. They know it's food, and then they are hardwired to hopefully go down and feed, but it's only when all the other pressures of people fishing and bad experience that comes in that can change
the danger.
The danger aspect of it, exactly. But it's very simple. If you take it back to what the carp can detect and you build your carp baits around that, you can very quickly dismiss a lot of other ingredients. You know, a lot of flavours. You know, a lot of flavours are glorified pH changes and nothing more.
So do you think this, what you're talking about there, the fermentation process and creating these aminos, we had Mark Holmes on a couple of weeks ago, and we were speaking about liquids a lot. He's focusing on that at the minute, and he's talking about like corn steep liquors, wheat steep liquors, kind of fermented sugar, obviously betaine, and I'm guessing this is kind of the same thing as what you're saying here.
It's all similar, yeah, exactly. If you look at all those products, they all have a common denominator or common chain. There's lots of ways you can break down those protein chains, and it can either be fermented, it can be with enzymes, there's a whole host of ways of doing it. But essentially, that is what the carp can detect. And having those liquid profiles within your bait, they're freely soluble, they're going to leach out of the bait, and you can have them products within the bait that latch on and pump those signals out very quickly. And that to me, that's, you know, that it's not as good as it's going to get, because there's always other things coming on the market. But in terms of attraction, that is where you want to be sort of, how you want to be sort of constructing and making your baits.
Mark was talking about just straight up alcohol, putting vodka in the bait and stuff. It sounded, or certainly in a mix, sounded a bit off the wall. But yeah. Have you ever? I remember the Kevin Nash whiskey one many years ago.
That was a flavour, wasn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, it kind of made sense what Holmesy was saying, you know, about the sort of fermentation process, and you know, yeast is a common ingredient, isn't it, in a lot of baits.
Marmite,
which is very similar. I mean, it's all kind of going down the same path, isn't it? We've obviously identified that carp like this kind of sugar. It seems to be the salt, which is key, the sugar. And this, you know, some sort of fermented liquor type thing. You know, the CSL was big many years ago, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
And I know DNA, one of the sponsors of the show, they do like a wheat steep, like a hydro wheat or something they call, which Holmes has been on about. But so a lot of these oils that people like glug baits and put in, I mean, they're not water soluble, are they? Are they giving attraction, or are they not?
It's interesting, the one with oils, because we sell oil products. We've got a hot fish oil, which is very, very spicy. And on paper, if you look at oil, the carp shouldn't be able to detect them. The only way they can detect them is if they're taking in through their mouth. If they're swimming over a baited area and a little oil droplet goes up into that cavity, into their mouth, they can detect it or taste it even. So oil shouldn't be, in theory, it's insoluble. And no one's be able to crack that, otherwise you'd be getting a Nobel Prize. There are elements within oil that are soluble, which diffuse out of the oil droplets, and I guess forget the carp can detect minute quantities. But what I like to use oil for, and what's a very interesting way, is you can use it as a vehicle. So if you take the products that you talked about, hydrolyzed wheat, I think, it's quite a dense product. It sinks down. So if you imagine we pour that into a lake and it sinks down around sort of the lake bed, that's going to be attractive to fish when they're bang within the vicinity, because they can detect a range, but once it diffuses out, then talk about what they can detect. It comes, you know, you need enough of that substance to flick their switch.
Yeah.
But what you can do with oils is interesting. You've got oil droplets that's always coming up off a baited area, and if you can mix the oils with soluble food signals, when you put oil into a jar and you put in something like soluble, like your hydrolyzed wheat I use for example, and you shake that bottle up, when you pour that in the lake, you've got the oil droplets that's going to rise up, taking some of the other product with it.
Stick into it and rising.
Exactly, and then it sort of goes on the, get a flat swap on the top, and then that food signal comes down. So that's increased the range from literally in and around the hook bait area to 10 foot high, and then if you get a wind, it's floating down the lake and floating off, and it's still sending those little minute droplets, so the fish can detect those and almost follow like a chum trail.
Yeah.
So I put great emphasis on that, and the oil is in the baits as well, the oil that goes into the boilies, that will fuse in with a lot of the ingredients and the flavours, soak into it almost, and then when that's rising, it's doing a similar sort of thing.
So What's the ultimate liquid, do you think? If you were to create a water column, a cloud of attraction without, you know, that's giving off food source without, you know, actual food, what would it be? What would the key ingredients be? You're trying to make it smell, do you think? Obviously, those aminos you're saying is a trigger.
Yeah, so
if you can get something like that into it.
So you're looking at products with a decent protein content, which is marine derived. So some of your fish concentrates, your krills, hydrostate. You've got a whole host of animal byproducts, which are this sort of process where it's either been enzyme treated or naturally fermented, as we sort of talked about. And because of the protein levels high, you've got a lot of the amino acids already there, just broken down into smaller chains. Whereas if you start with something like wheat, it's very, very limited in terms of amino acid content. Small, yeah. Not enough, not very high in particularly all of them. But those will sort of be broken down into smaller chains. So if you start with a higher protein source, and that's sort of marine derived, that is where I'd be sort of starting. And then obviously the how soluble is that compound in water? Has it had the oil removed? Has it some of the concentrates still have the oil within the product, and that can go a bit gobblier. Whereas some of the concentrates are very, very soluble. You tip them into water and they get like a cloud, and that's what you're trying to look. So it's trying to sort of sift through those. But a good starting point at the moment is the fish proteins or the krills, and that are very good. The old what was the old concentrate? It's been discontinued now by Seagarden. Totally forgot the name of it. It's left me. based on shellfish and fish and all sorts, but those sort of products are, I'm not going to say as good as it gets, but they are very, very attractive to fish, and there's no doubt that when the fish detect those, they know it's food.
Yeah, well, you seem to certainly know your stuff. I've tried expanding my mind a little bit, because I don't understand a lot, but what I have, the people that I spoke to recently doing the show and stuff, there's a lot of the same conclusions coming around now. You know, a lot of people mention the similar products, the processes, the aminos, like you say, the krill and the fish products. So it seems that you certainly know your stuff. B, I think I would 100% trust using your bait. I mean, what are your best sellers? What if somebody listening to this decides they want to try out Baitworks? What direction would you point them in straight away?
We've got the Atlantic Heat, which is probably our first beta released. That's been going now for over a decade, and that's caught up absolutely everywhere. That's the one bait. If people come to us, they usually come in to use that. But we do get a lot of guys also order the Sent From Hell pop-ups, which are an absolute abomination to make. They absolutely stink. Anyone who's used them will know what I'm talking about. It absolutely stinks. Everything stinks in my house of it. My dog stinks of it. My steering wheel stinks of it. But they're very hugely, hugely popular. But whatever bait company you go with, just do a bit of homework. I think that's the key.
Yeah, and what's actually in those pop-ups? What are they called?
Sent from Hell, that's a great name.
We've
got a Sent From Heaven, which is a more fruitier version, but Sent From Hell is a blend of four different flavour profiles, organic acids, there's monosaccharides in there, so very simple sugars, but it's just a very, very potent single hook bait. Big pH change. It's something you can put out a standalone product, and people fish it over bait, fish it as singles. It's just a very, very good pop-up, especially for this time of year and going into winter. It's classic.
I quite fancy a try of them myself.
I should have bought one over.
Just for the Sent From Hell. But I like the idea. I mean, I've always been somebody that's tried to get fish going by baiting. You know, I've never used to feel confident fishing singles. I've caught on them, but I'd much rather get fish feeding in an area and then look at attractive baits over the top of that. But I'm always interested when I ever speak to somebody who's good with single hook bait fishing, and they put the emphasis on how good the hook bait is. And
It's a leap of faith.
It is, yeah. But you know, you're saying you specifically have a good single hook bait attractor, and this pH thing keeps coming up a lot as well in the chats that we've had.
Yeah, so carp, they can detect pH changes within the water, and that to me is an investigative trigger, what I call it. So it's not a feeding trigger, it's investigative. So there's something mimicking. So they will come across an area that's a pH change. I personally think that's that pH change, they find that naturally within the lakes. I think it's potentially coming from like bloodworm when they're defecating, for a posh word, or cracking. Yeah. I couldn't think of a word then. When they secrete ammonia, that's giving off a subtle pH change. When there's enough of a bed of bloodworm is in high density and they're giving off enough of those, they're secreting or cracking. Yeah. I think that's giving off a subtle pH change that the fish are clocked into. They go over and they investigate. And when it gets to a level where there's lots of them, that's where they go and harvest it.
Yeah,
but it only flicks their trigger when it gets to a certain level,
right?
They can detect. So on single hook baits, a lot of the flavours, sort of the very, very successful flavours, are either acidic or alkaline. Yeah. And you can pep up hook baits by using products like citric acid. I know you had Frank Warwick on.
He spoke a lot about that. And Holmesy again touched on this, making esters and stuff and using the citric. I think it was citric and alcohol. He was talking about an ester. I forget what an ester is now, not being scientifically minded.
Yeah.
But again, people keep touching on the same things. And I know Frank talks about the pH years ago, didn't he? And
the
single hook baits and stuff. And so if you were to use, does it work as a single hook bait? Or, I mean, if you wanted to trigger that big signal you were just talking about, like a big bloodworm bed or whatever, I mean, have you tried beds of bait that, you know, change the pH of the water rather than single hook baits, but, you know, big piles of it, and how do the fish react to that?
Well, within our baits that we produce, there are pH changes within that, be it in the flavour profiles or some of the sort of touched on sort of organic acids as well, which give off a subtle change. But when you're putting out sort of 30, 40, 100 baits, 200 baits, that's a lot of signals going into the water there, and that's enough. You know, there's no doubt when the fish come over, bed of boilers, they know exactly what it is, and they know the danger is probably involved as well. Whereas a single hook bait thing, it's especially this time of year, you're tapping into something different. You know, in terms of when they're coming over, they're seeing one, it's provoked an interest, an investigative trigger. They've gone down and they have to sample it with their mouth. Is the only way they can
their hands, isn't it?
But it does come down to you know what the carp can actually detect, and once you look into that, it does. You know, it was like a, I wouldn't say it's a revelation, but it really opened my eyes to all the cloud that's around the bait industry. There's some great books out there, scientific books as well, which you can sort of delve. You can disappear, you know, for years on end, really into the white papers and all that. But there's some nuggets there. And when you actually look at what carp can detect, as I say, they're very simple creatures. They're hardwired to detect certain things.
Yeah.
And they investigate others. And I think once you get the grasp of that, then the bait making suddenly, I wouldn't say it becomes easy, but it becomes, you can be much more focused, and you're not wasting money on other ingredients so much. Sort of when I very first started out, you can read articles to be influenced by all manner of things. But at the end of the day, say once you learn what the fish can detect, then you're on the right path.
Yeah, you've opened my mind again, and there's so many things to look at here, because like you say, there's people that seem to know their stuff keep saying the same things to me. I can't ignore it anymore. But we've been an hour now, so which is about as long as we go with the interviews. I'd like to thank you. Where can we go to get your stuff? Is it, what's the Baitworks website?
So it's baitworks.co.uk.
Yeah, Baitworks with an X for all you people interested in that. I'm going to check out these Scent from Hell pop-ups and the nicer ones and the fruity ones. I do fancy trying those. But Mr. Mark Bryant, thank you very much for joining the Carpcast.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks to Mark, and thanks for taking time out to come and see me while we were fishing. And it's a fantastic area of the country. It's an area that I fished during my teens, and I'm glad to see he's doing a lot for the local area. And wow, to have escaped with his life like that. I mean, it must be pretty eye-opening to have a second chance at life, really. You're not going to waste a day, I don't think, after escaping death, certain death as well. but yeah, there we go. So as promised, we're going to play out for you. We'll leave it to the end of the show, Mark. Should we play out the Carpcast social listeners' questions with Julian Cundiff, myself, you, and a sizzling barbecue in the background?
I think, though, I think Matt Bailiff Brummy Matt spoke more than, I don't think I spoke at all, but I'd had a few bits to drink and I just kind of sat there listening and wobbling a bit.
Yeah, you're not too good on your beers these days, are you?
No, I'm a complete lightweight, but you're on there making sense. Jules makes sense, and Matt is also a quality angler. He tricks his two penny thing as well, so enjoy listening.
Enjoy, and we'll see you next week.
We're absolutely everywhere. Yeah. It's just that this would fit your rather than picking me up,
wouldn't it? So we're a few beers deep. We had a fantastic talk from Julian. There's myself, Julian, Mark, that claim to know a few things about fishing. but we are open to criticism. But we're here, to field questions, serious, carpy, technical, or ridiculous. If anybody wants to start us off about any subject whatsoever, such as why did I cut this hot dog roll the wrong way?
It's already pre-cut.
Yeah.
I'll just preface this with the fact I'm 5 beers deep. But no, anyone got anything you want to know about anything?
Come on, guys. Somebody must want to know.
I just want to know about the time on tap. I know it's a bit of a touchy subject with being that
fish and all that stuff. It's not touchy.
How you went about it? You know.
So the basic score with Tatton, known as the Deer Park, some lads that I know, a couple of mainline guys, they discovered these fish, two commons and a mirror. Probably, they were good friends of Ali Hamidi, who was a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
And he told me about them catching these fish probably 6 months before it hit the press. And what had happened...
Is this for the first time before...
This is the very first time, yeah. Before. What had happened is the local Knutsford guys had stocked these fish from a lake down the road that was stuffed full of commons. They'd popped them in Tatton Park, which is like an 80-acre lake. just for you audio listeners, that was my fork snapping. They stocked these fish years ago and they'd fished them. Half the lake wasn't even controlled by any angling club. You could just walk in any time of day or night and fish. Nobody ever bothered. These fish got left alone. They got big. And there's an end of the lake that's called the Duck Pond, which is like a quarter of an acre and 3 foot deep. And the fish are there all summer.
Yeah, down bottom end.
So somebody had seen these fish. These two mainline lads had seen these fish and gone, blimey, they're big. Let's fish for them. Which they did. They caught them. One was a 40, which was a big fish at the time. Especially for the northwest, it was a big fish for the country, let alone the northwest. They caught them. They wrote about them in someone's book. I forget which book it was, but they had a chapter in there called the Deer Park. These fish got bigger and bigger, and then a chap that I know called Richard Seal, who
Richard and Ben, yeah, John Seal's sons, yeah, John's sons.
John Seal is used to be. Solicitor for the is a very well known lawyer,
yeah,
including for the Carp Society in the early days. Richard went on there, caught both these fish at ridiculous weights. The big fish was 50 odd pound, known as the barrel, and the other one was a good 40. They both made the front cover of Carp Talk. I was like, wow, I already knew about these fish like 5 or 6 years before, and I was like, got to catch these fish. They're in like an hour's drive. I've been driving 4 hours to catch big fish. I did some research, found out that this fish, since the guys that had ever stocked the fish, the way they fished for them was to sneak on there at night. There was no police in the lake, really. There's a few wardens that wander around in the daytime, but they're just council employees on day control. There is a 200 section of bank you can fish in the daytime. It's an 80 acre lake. There's 200 yards of legal fishing. The people who stocked the fish and the people that caught the fish, all the known captures of these fish, which was probably only less than half a dozen, had all come from fishing the far side at night. Now, the Outer Bounds wasn't even fenced off. You could walk in there, anybody could walk in there day or night, set up in the woods, and nobody would even know you were there. There wasn't even police. Like, it wasn't like, blimey, somebody's
like
breaking the
now,
rules.
It's more now.
It's not
it?
Even...
It's not, but they do night.
It is police now.
Yeah.
but no, it's not. When I caught the barrel, there'd been 5 captures previously of that fish, I think, ever. Maybe 4, maybe I was the 5th. But not many. Anyway, that was how the lake was fished. Now, we talked about petty pull before. We talked about a certain angler setting up, like, in the far side of the lake, 300 yards from where anyone can cast, while there's people queuing at the gate at 3 a.m. ready to fish for the morning, and he was basically stealing their fish. That's not how the people fished Tatton. There was nobody that fished it legitimately. There was no carp syndicate that fished that lake legally, because there was no legal. It was 200 yards of bank in an 80 acre lake that tench anglers fished and a few pole anglers fished. Nobody ever caught carp from the legal section. Them carp have never been caught legally. So when I went on there and fished it as in Rome, when the Romans do,
nobody had ever fished it any other way. That's how the fish was stocked, that's how the fish had been fished for nearly 10 years, and that's how I caught them, the same as everybody previous to me and everybody since me. So as far as poaching, like, I'll have a joke with people, yeah, you only fish it out of bounds. Yeah, I did fish it at night, but that's how every single other captured and fish had happened, yeah. And for me, that's fair game, because that's how those fish get caught. And nobody to this day has ever caught them any other way, and just because of the nature of the lake.
I've seen photos of a certain angler with holding one of the fish on the legal bank down, like, in the duck pond. Is that a little...
Well, first of all, the legal bank is about...
Half to three quarters of a mile from the
duck pond, and yes, what you think is true. It wasn't caught from the legal bank. Yeah. That guy was, if he'd have fished it legitimately as he'd have claimed, he'd have had to got in the gate at 7 a.m, caught it by 5 past, photographed it by 10 past, and was home by 4 past. Yeah. For him to have actually done what he claimed to have done, the fish was clearly caught in the night from the duck pond. Brought up to the legal area, waited for his missus to come in at 7 a.m, took the pictures and went home. Nobody denies that, even him.
Sounds like
we're going to have to bleep
for
that
perch.
We're going to have to bleep that bit out, because I'm probably going to fish at some point in the future.
For perch.
Does anybody here know about that?
No.
I'm going to bleep it out, right? That lake is 20 minutes from here.
Yeah.
It's got maybe 3 50 pounders in it.
One?
Okay. One. And a shitload of footage.
Mm. Is it not allowed to fish? Is it illegal?
It's a park lake. Yeah, there's electronic gauge. You can get in at 7 o'clock. Anyone can fish it.
Similar to Tatton, basically.
There's more fishing than Tatton.
Yeah.
There is a good amount more fish. But
you can fish the whole lake, pretty much.
One bank has most of it, but it's a dammed river. Mm-hmm. There's a waterfall in one end.
No, I've not fished it yet. I do plan on doing it. I am going to bleep the name of the lake out, by the way.
No serious time, though.
No, but it is so problematic.
Yeah.
That you need to be physically fit.
Don't know what that one is.
With your gear.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Come on, then let's have a more interesting question.
Let's not get political. Let's talk about fishing. How we can get better as anglers. Not how we can poach lakes. You shouldn't really be poaching.
That's the most interesting subject, though, isn't it?
Well, I'm happy. I'll answer anything about anything. I can honestly say I've caught a couple of fish from out of bounds, and I've never fished any lake in any different way to everybody else that have caught them fish before and after me. I would never go to a lake that normal people are fishing it in a normal way and then do something against the rules. Would never do that. First of all, because the capture would get put down. Everybody would go, oh, he caught that. Cheating. Like, I would never do that. If on Yateley nobody used bait hooks and I went and caught the biggest fish in the lake with a bait boat, I'd feel like it wasn't a proper capture. Bought a bait boat. In fact, I didn't even buy one, I borrowed one, because every single person on that lake used a bait boat. I'd never used a bait boat. I'd rather there was no bait boats allowed, but everybody used a bait boat. I was at a disadvantage if I didn't. If I'd have fished Tatton legally, I'd have never caught those fish, and I'd have been at a disadvantage against everybody that caught those fish. So I will only do what is the norm on a lake, and I would never break a rule that nobody else breaks. If everybody goes, maggots are banned on here, but every single fish has been caught on maggots, right? I'll use maggots, because that's how everybody catches those fish. Maybe I might want to cut my nose off to spite my face just to prove a point and go, I'm going to catch one, boys. Maybe I would do that because I'm an arsehole. But generally, like, if
you'd catch some first on maggots, though, wouldn't you?
I don't know. Like, if I couldn't catch... cut my nose off and spike my face, I'd do what everybody else did. If everybody else uses something that's banned, nuts, maggots, whatever it is, then I'm not going to not catch fish just to, like, prove a point against what everyone else does. I'm going to do what it does. But if nobody uses maggots and I knew I could catch fish using maggots, I still wouldn't use maggots. I'd do it the same way everyone else does it. And that's generally my morals. I would never, like, bend the rules to give myself an edge. That I've never break a rule to give myself an edge that other people don't have. I'd rather pit myself against the fish, the rules, everything else, unless nobody does. And then I would do it.
You know yourself then, don't you, that you've done it?
You're only cheating yourself as well. I'm not the sort of person that camps in the outer bounds when everyone else is queuing at the gate at 3 a.m. just to put a picture in the magazine and pretend I'm better than everyone else. That like, where's the gain in that? That's narcissism. That's feeding an ego. I don't have an ego. Like, I'll take the piss out of myself. I'll blank. I'll catch. I'll fall in the lake. You know, whatever it is. But it is what it is. I would never like do anything to appear to be better than everyone else or to pretend that I am or whatever. So they're my morals, and I'm happy with them. I've seen forums all over the place. You fish this lake in the out of bounds, you did this. These people don't know the truth. Everyone who was there knows. Everyone who fished that lake before or after, they know. And everyone else doesn't really matter. They can say what they want. But anyway, yeah, let's get some carpy knowledge. Game changes, yours, what's yours?
Me? I think for my biggest game changer was watching Andy Little fish and realise that actually I wasn't as good as I was. My game changer was accepting that I wasn't as good as I thought I was.
And Andy Little's a name from the past.
Yeah. He still fishes, yeah.
What did you teach the media about?
Everything. Everything. I watched what he was doing and accepted it wasn't the fact that he was lucky, but he was better. And biggest game changers are accepting that other people actually are trying harder, doing more, getting up earlier, fishing longer, making sacrifices. There are some people who get lucky. They're not game changers. If somebody is consistently lucky, and you kid yourself, you are kidding yourself. Yeah, if you look beyond, people like Terry Hearn and people like that, and Dave Lane, are not lucky. They will have lucky spells. They are game. They are catching what they catch because they make sacrifices. And that sacrifice might be not having a family. That sacrifice might be giving up the job. That sacrifice might be having no money and not having a nice car. Whatever, you know. So to me, the biggest game changer is accepting it's not down to luck and it's down to effort. That for me is the biggest game changer. There are 5% of people who, no matter how much time they spend, how much money they spend, how prolific a walker they spend, they will not catch carp. And there are 5% of people who just have got it, who have got it. But there are 90% of people in carp fishing who, the harder they try, the luckier they get. You know, it's a golfing thing, isn't it? Somebody said it's a golfer, Jack Nicklaus, or somebody said it. But generally, the great thing about carp fishing is the harder you try, the luckier you get. 5% of people who are naturally gifted. I think at every sport, be it golf, tennis, anything, there are 5% of naturals. But the majority of people in carp fishing, the harder they try, the more they do it, the more they accept that they're not invincible, the better they get. That's my biggest game changer, was accepting I need to try harder. Everything. I try... Every single thing that I did better. So it could be smaller hooks, sharper hooks, better casting, more accuracy, looking at the water more. There is no... In the olden days, a game changer could be tiger nuts, the bent hook, being able to fish at range, fishing longer. Those days are gone. Game changers are now or getting everything right. There ain't no game changers. The chod was a bit of a game changer, things like that. But generally, the days of game changers, one thing are gone, in my opinion.
I think the chod was a game changer for the bottom 50% of anglers.
Yeah.
So, like, your pleasure guys, the people that never felt the lead down, and 80% of the time they're fishing, the rig wasn't presented properly. They were maybe in weed, but they wouldn't even know it. They reel it in the next morning, it's thick weed, they go, oh, I've wasted a night on that rod. Oh, I reeled my second rod in.
Wasted.
Was in weed too. Right. Those, a lot of anglers that are not particular about stuff, pleasure anglers, when they were casting out, not feeling the lead, not finding the spot accurately first, they probably weren't fishing. 70% of the time they had bait in the water was probably wasted. When they turned to a chod, they were fishing 98% of the time, wherever it landed. And that was a game changer for certainly the bottom 50-60%, and it was a game changer for the top 50%, because we could now fish in areas that we couldn't present a bait before, that we just left. Fish were showing there, can't find any spots, don't fish there. Now even the really, really good anglers can fish in places they couldn't fish before, and the really bad anglers probably up their catch rate 60-70%, because they're now fishing almost all the time they put a bait in the water. So I think I think Chod's was a real game changer for the majority, and I think Zig's is the most recent game changer and probably the biggest game changer we're going to see in the next 10 years, because we never fished. We fish surface baits and we fish bottom baits. We didn't fish anything in between, which is where fish spend 99% of their life. They drop when they feed, they swim on the top when it's red hot. The bit in the middle is everything else. And all of a sudden, they're now getting caught there. First of all, they're not used to getting caught there. They're not wary, they're not scared of stuff. They're just looking at a little black bit of foam and going, I wonder what that is. Why? I think that's the biggest game changer. And I think the advancement of that, as we get better at it, learning what fly anglers know, what hatches at certain times of the year, adapting our depths, adapting our types of hook baits to stuff that we don't know as carp anglers, but you know, fly anglers probably take it as second nature. I think Zig's have got a lot of progressing to do over the next few years.
And that's why Jamie's fishing three bottom baits today.
This leads me to my question. That's to you, Jules. Like, do you use Zig's?
No, I'm not good. I use Zig's, but I'm not very good on them. I'm a better surface angler, and I'm a better bottom angler. Zig's, I'm not a good angler. I accept I'm not a good angler, so I play to my strengths.
And then, so then, if you're in a situation where you don't feel like you're going to get a bite from the bottom, and you don't feel like you're going to get a bite from the top.
Go home.
So is that what you're saying? You wouldn't.
No.
If you was in that
if
situation,
I'm not getting a bite on the bottom and I'm not getting a bite on the top, and I'm seeing somebody catching on Zig's, then I will use Zig. That will be my third tactic. First tactic will be the bottom. Second tactic is the surface. Third tactic is a Zig. Now, that's me being honest. I can tell you all sorts of palaver about fishing Zig's and all this and make you sound like I'm great angler. No. My initial, obviously depending what time it is a year, you know, I can catch them well on the surface, I can catch them well on the bottom. I'm not a great Zig angler. That's a massive area I've got to look at for my fishing. And if somebody next to me is catching fish on Zig's, I will be straight on Zig's.
And is that what you intend on doing, brushing up on your Zigging?
Absolutely, yeah. That's, you know, it's no good me saying I'm a great angler and not being a proficient angler on Zig's because I'm kidding myself.
Yeah.
But I know many good anglers who catch a lot of carp on the surface, and I mean well-known names, who hardly ever use Zig's.
I don't use them myself, like, and it's something that interests me, for sure, to use them. But like you say, if something's not broke, you don't sort of fix it. But
I'm happy
I've been
I
in a situation when people around me are sort of catching on Zig's, and I'm not catching.
I'll be straight on them. I'll be his best mate, and I'll be seeing exactly how far the bottom off it is. Yeah, absolutely.
And but is that what you'd do? You'd go and ask them questions?
Of course I would, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's it. Well, there's some people out there that are sort of high up in the chain that would refuse to go and sort of ask that advice.
It's good luck to them. They can look at a dry net all day. I'm prepared to look at a wet net all day. Yeah, I'm quite happy to give advice and ask for advice. And if somebody don't want to tell me, they don't want to tell me. But generally... No, I look at what Jamie's doing, I look at what Mark's doing, I look at what everybody's doing and think, is that going to give me an advantage? Nobody's above taking advice. The first person that tells me they're above taking advice might as well put a cone on their head to me.
Yeah.
What's the best bit of it? Don't get married.
It is like, I can be an arrogant git at times and but I'm opinionated, but I'm the most open-minded to something that I don't know. So I might have an opinion on something based on what I know. If somebody tells me something, I go, wow, light bulb. Yes.
Would you go off then and do your own research to change your view overnight, if you know what I mean?
I know it's true, but generally we're bright enough to know that that's really logical what they're saying. I've already thought about whatever it is for my opinion. And when somebody tells me something that I hadn't thought of, and I go, wow, that just makes complete sense. Yeah, maybe if it's something that's off the wall, I might go and check it out for myself, but usually...
And that's what I do. I'll ask a certain question or two, but I won't stand there and sort of punish someone and brown nose to get that information.
Fishing, I'm talking generally, but fishing is completely unsolved. You know, we know stuff now we didn't know 5 years ago.
And I think in 10 years from now, we're still going to be in that same boat.
Yeah.
You know, there's always an answer. Basically, yeah, you've got an opinion to some things, and I've got an opinion to some things, and you're right with your opinions, but likewise, so am I. Do you see what
right,
I mean?
Yeah, and the difference is I might be right in spring, and you might be right in autumn, and someone else might have a better method for July.
Or for that certain lake, yeah. as opposed to that lake.
Because you found what you found, you might have done hammered a lake in autumn and worked out this, and the fish go here, and you've used this type of bait, and that doesn't apply to April or March. Or
carp fishing is not an exact science. It's not algebra or mathematics where 2 and 2 is 4. The 2 and 2 is 4, but in carp fishing, every water's different, every carp's different, the bottom's different. And if you were to get the 10 most well-known and successful carp anglers in the country, I guarantee that probably 90% of them use different baits, 90% of them use different rigs, 90% of them use different tactics, and you would go, wow. But they all use different things, different tactics, and they all work. And that's because they're confident in them.
Yeah. I had a mate that was obsessed.
That's it, confidence
about
catches fish, don't it?
He was obsessed. Stiff links, Terry Hurst style, 3-inch pop-ups. And I was using bottom baits at the time, straight out of the bag. And we were both similar sort of competence level on Wire Lake 14 years ago. We fished the autumn on the same day, 3 nights a week, Monday to Thursday, every week. He fished his way, I fished my way, we finished up with exactly the same amount of fish, 24 fish each from like September till November when we both stopped fishing, exact same amount of time and opposite methods. And one session I had 5, he had 1, and next session he had 4, I had 1, or blanks, and we finished up with 24 fish each, fishing opposite methods.
Yeah, I think what you have to do is you have to keep an open mind, and the guys who have an open mind and prepare to change will catch them up.
Yeah,
you cannot be regimented in your thinking and think, do you know what, that is the only way to catch them. So if I see somebody catching something on a tactic I would not normally use, and they are definitely got a headway, I now will immediately change. I will change onto what they're doing, and then I'll start piecing it together for myself. Because I have sat too many times and gone, he should not be out fishing me on that rig, that bait, that tactic. And then about a week later he still is, and a month later he still is. I will not do that. Now I'm open to change. That's the biggest advantage. As soon as I see Summer is working better than me, I will change. Or, you know, occasionally people will get a fluke capture, but I think the more experienced you are as an angler, the more you realise actually it wasn't fluke. He's doing something you're not doing. So you may think he's dropping short. Actually,
he might not know he's doing it though.
He might not know he's doing it, but if you can copy him and then know why it's working, you've got a massive advantage.
Well, definitely. At the end of the day, we condition the fish to react the way they do. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And that's why you'll get a certain lads all turn up to a lake, if you like, and fishing similar and same sort of styles, and then you'll get what people would sort of class as a noddy.
And he'll do something different.
And he'll turn up and put out that spiralled rig that isn't steamed like we were talking about earlier, and it's curled up on the bottom. But them fish are conditioned to pick up a rig that is straight, or to be weary around rigs that are dead straight with a lead at the one end and a pink pop-up at the
fish
other.
Fish have different characteristics. Have you ever different been things. On a lake where one angler keeps catching the same fish? No one else catches it. One angler has it 5 times in a year.
Yeah.
Now that's because of however he fishes. It's just the way he fishes. Maybe he uses 7-inch hook links, maybe he uses 11-inch hook links, whatever. The way that fish feeds suits the rig that he uses.
Well, definitely,
I've got a rig. He keeps catching it.
I've got a rig that it's a bit of a combi rig, curve shank on it. It's quite an aggressive curve. And that rig seems to just pick out the underslung mouth fish, you know what I mean?
Which are usually the trickiest fish to catch.
And I've just found that that rig, I can put the same, a similar sort of setup, but not tied the same, and I wouldn't have caught that fish. It's like they can deal with that rig.
The trick is to realise when somebody's catching fish because they're in the swim, and when somebody's catching fish because of the bait or the rig.
Or they're doing
something different. So you have got to say to yourself, is that guy catching them because he's got 90% of the fish in his swim, or is that guy doing something different? Is he dropping short, trying something different? And the more experienced you are, the more you will get that answer. The less experienced you are, you will go, oh, it's because he's using metal pop-ups. The more experienced you are, you will go, no, it's actually because there's a huge amount of fish in that swim and there's none in front of me and I don't need to change. I need to get nearer him. That's experience. You can't buy experience. Corda, Nash, Fox cannot sell experience.
Yeah.
They can sell hooks, they can sell monos, they can sell rods and reels, but they cannot sell experience that tells you to change.
What you can do, though, is learn from observation. So you've you've told all of us here that Rosie's been coming out on pink baits, right?
I was just going to get there.
To catch, right? So you'd be daft if you didn't have one of your rods on a pink bait.
Of course.
But maybe Hardy doesn't like a pink bait, right? So if you fished all your rods on pink bait, you're never going to catch Hardy.
That's
right?
It, and that's why I always put one out in, on pink.
So what I try to do to is to always do, like the one guy that catches the one fish, he might not even know why he keeps catching that same fish, right? But he's doing something that does it. So I've always tried to fish three rods slightly different, even if they're on the same spot. One will be on the pink bait, one will be on a pop-up, one will be on a snowman, one might be on a 5-inch hook link, and you're on a 10-inch hook link.
That's what Jamie fishes five rods.
But there's no point in doing the same thing on three rods because you're going to keep catching the same.
And that's exactly what I would do.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Gary Bays told me years ago about mixing the bait, using two different flavours, and sometimes I'll use. I just think it's confusing tactics, so the fish can't kind of get onto what's the hook bait, but I just think it's because fish have different preferences. You might like fat birds, I might like skinny birds, you know, some people like Chinese, Asian women, whatever. Point is, fish are the same. I think you can relate animals to other things that you've witnessed or seen. So if, no two people the same, we're all human beings, but all individual, like, we've got our taste. You like cider, I like lager. Whatever it is. Now, fish have personalities. If you listen to the Rob Hughes Carp Cast, he says exactly that. He says some are characters, some are the bosses, some push the others out of the way for food, some are the shy ones that sit at the back of the pack. They all have their own personalities, and he's learned that from swimming with them, from being down there. And he said you can see it in them, just the way they do. Some of them do it because of danger, some of them do it because of genetics, just because of how they are.
So what makes you think that? Why does Rosie pick up the pink every time? Every time
it
she
could
gets
be something
nailed,
to do with, she might be half blind, she might be short sighted for all we know, she might need to wear specs, who knows.
But she always comes off a big baited area.
Like, maybe she's just greedy. Maybe she likes loads of boilies. She eats the first two, going, nah, I'm going to leave that chocolate cake today, forget it.
But this is
second
what
one, and going, nah, fuck that, I'm going to
get this is
that.
What I'm saying,
the
there's 10
one,
kia
goes,
bait.
I'm eating it all.
There's like, 10 kia bait, there's two rigs on that spot. One of them's on a pink pop up, and one of them's on the bait. She always
matter.
Comes out around this 10 kia bait.
Maybe she's attracted by the bait, but only makes a mistake on the pink.
Doesn't really
so,
matter. Our
so
job
you
is
think maybe she's not picking up the bait.
She's maybe
she's just going for the pink.
Straight for the pink. As I don't even touch the bait on the pink.
I'll give you a clue. I mean, I love the smell of the barbecue, right? I love the smell of the barbecue. That makes me feel hungry. But I think if I have all that meat, I'm going to feel lethargic. So what did I have? I had a piece of cheese in bread. And I
you'll
think
you'll be the hardest fish in the lake.
I've the hardest fish, you? But that's I think
I'm the muggy bream, yeah. On the shelf here.
And I do think that carp are, you know, they're like humans. We all have different characteristics, and there's certain things that will stimulate carp to feed, but there are certain things they won't get caught on. And what may stimulate them to feed might not be what they got caught on.
Yeah.
So there will be carp that are attracted to masses of bait. But they
but
will be wary.
It,
but
pick
won't
up the
be
pink
wary.
That's sitting on top.
Absolutely. And I do think sometimes fishing one off,
but our
off
job
the bait.
Is just to notice that. If yeah. you notice that Julian only eats the cheese sandwich on the edge of the barbecue, right?
Which I did.
If you want to catch Julian, if you want to catch Julian, you don't put out the Moroccan lamb, do you?
No. Like, I want that Moroccan lamb. I want it, but I.
Well, our job is just to notice that.
And that's
you've
experience.
Noticed that Rosie takes the pink baits. Now, I wouldn't fish all my rods every week on pink baits, but I definitely.
How do we
sure
encourage Julian time. To have a bit of Moroccan lamb? That's the next question.
A little bit of GLM in the trail.
I mean, that's the experience.
We'll as cheese him into the lamb.
As an experienced angler, you
well, we
recognise
patterns. Rock up to spawning bay and starve him forever.
Or wrap up the lamb in cheese.
Yeah, yeah, as an experienced angler, you that's what you can't
you're
buy.
Yeah.
It's time teaches you that. The less experienced you are, you will not pick up the patterns up. The more experienced you are, if you went fishing with Rod Hutchins and Terry Earn and people like that who've got years of experience, they will just go, well, it's quite obvious they're going to be down here on this wind. It's quite obvious. And you'll think, yeah, that is obvious, but if I'd walked on there on my own, I wouldn't
have
known.
It wouldn't have been obvious to you.
What I knew 10 years ago, 10 years ago, I probably thought it was good. I look back and think 10 years ago, God, I didn't know half I know now. 10 years from now, I will be 10 years better angler.
Yeah.
And you can't
because
buy
it's
that.
Experience.
Yeah, yeah, it's experience.
Learning every day in life generally. As long as you're observant and you take in what you witness.
Open minded.
You've seen Julian just eat a cheese sandwich, so you would never fish a Moroccan body for him, would you? Because you know he's not going to eat it, even if he wants it. It's not.
I wanted it, believe me. I wanted
what
it.
You've got to do.
Vincent's chasm on stone break bread.
But like, I always think everything in nature does it for a reason. We might not know that reason, right? We might not know why certain species of bird, when it hits 57 degrees, decides it doesn't like England anymore. It wants to go to wherever, somewhere colder, somewhere warmer, or whatever. We just notice that, well, the hell, the birds have just shot off. And we go, oh, hang on, it's the 7th of November. And then the year after, you go, well, it's the 10th of November, and that's that same group of birds getting off again. And on the third year, you're going to go, I
they've
know them birds
book,
are
yeah.
leaving on the 10th of November, like, or between the 7th and the 11th. Your job's just to notice, and experience does that. So when you fish the lake for 3 years, and you go, the fish always turn up in this peg in winter, or that fish always gets caught from there on that bar at like...
Yeah, it's having that open mind to receive it.
Yeah, and you can't just learn it the first season.
It takes time.
It's going to take time. Or learn it off other people. Like, you know, I've come down here, I now know that Rosie likes a pink bait. I might not have come next week and fished a pink bait, but we've just done a bit of homework. We found out that that's what it does.
Well, that's like
targeting
me.
Targeting an individual carp. Like.
See, I'll put a pink bait out knowing that Rosie comes up, but I'll only do it on one rod. But in the time that I've been doing that, I've been picking up other fish.
Of course,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you might not.
Whereas before, I was anti-pink.
Like pink bait,
do you know what I mean? I was never confident in using pink, and I built up my confidence by putting it out for Rosie, not catching Rosie, but getting amongst other fish.
Yeah, you have to have
journey,
a starting
you know
point,
I mean?
But you have to have an open mind. So you've got the yin and the yang competing against each other. There's the I know that a multi-rig with a white pop-up or a key pop-up is going to work, and then there's a yang going. Yeah, but the pink pop-up picks the bigger fish. And it's in time, you will know when to change. You will know when it's just one of those. You'll know when it's one of those things, and you'll know when you need to change. And you can't buy that. That's I can't have the same experience as somebody who's got 10 years more carping than me. He will have 10 years more on me, and I can't buy that.
Yeah.
It's the same in any job, isn't it? You can be a bricklayer. You can start within 2 weeks of being bricklayer or whatever, or a year, you know.
You can't
know.
You
can be as good as the guy who's been doing it 5 years or 10 years or whatever. You know?
Well, well, there is a stage, obviously, where there's catching up. You can catch up with that guy.
Yeah, of course you
if he's not as open-minded as what you are, you could catch up in years and experience over him because he's not willing to accept the fact that they come out on zigs. Do you see what I mean? But you're willing to accept that, so you can then catch up in the years of experience.
That's why
with less experience, just by having an open mind.
10 or 15 years ago, a new thing wouldn't get distributed around as much, so an edge would be an edge for a longer time. Those edges are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, because as soon as somebody finds something that works, it's on social media, it's in the magazines, it's by word of mouth, and it's gone. So nowadays, one thing will not buy you the edge. Your edge is everything. It's time, it's swim, it's everything.
It's back to that percentage
thing,
isn't it? You know what I mean?
The percentages are getting less big and smaller, but you have to get more of them. So instead of something that's 20% an advantage, you need six things that are 3%, because you aren't going to find now, unless the fish are in one swim, that one thing is going to do it. Zigs may do it, as Jamie said, because that's a massive advantage. If you can get zigs to work, that could be a 30-40% advantage. However, for the majority of this, it's 2% here, 1% there, 3% there, 1% there, and it all adds up.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's zigs are the next big 20%er, for want of a better word.
Yeah, there hasn't been a 20%er since the chod rig was a 20%er.
Yeah.
The hair rig was 100%er. No, 500%er. Probably caught you five times the fish that you did pre hair rig. Will there ever be another hair rig?
No,
probably not.
I don't think
so. But I think the chod was a 20%er for the bottom 50% and a 10%er for everyone else.
Yeah.
The zigs are definitely a 20%er.
I mean, I think people get misled as well, because you might find something that's on a water that can be a 30% advantage for whatever reason. But when you look at it globally, it might be 30% of one water and it might do nothing on another water. As Jamie said, there are certain things like chods that on any water or weed were a huge advantage. You know, floater fish on a water that's never been floater fish can be a massive advantage, but on a water that's been brayed on floaters, it's no advantage. Chod, as you say, was such an advantage on virtually every weedy water.
the chud was there before it came out to the public. The chud was already there, wasn't it? It was unnamed.
It was unnamed.
And it was sort of kept in the closet.
Yeah, it was the silk rig, the paternoster rig, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
There's another one.
Did you say Frank Rorick was in the closet? Is he out the closet now? Is that right?
Listening to this.
Has anyone else got anything on talking about emerging bugs? For Ziggs, do you reckon that'll be the next big thing, replicating sort of the
I think so, yeah.
Accurately as well.
I've not put it out yet, but I recorded about 4 hours of Nashi, and he talks about a lake he fished with Alan up the road from his. It's like a... There's one...
Tidal, is it? Not what, the tidal one.
Not sure, you probably know the name. Yeah. It's there's a couple of big fish in there, yeah. Come out very rarely. And he ended up catching it twice in 2 days on a glow bug, I think.
That's the one, yeah.
It's a Zig bug that glows. I've actually got some with me, I've not tried them. you can buy them now, I think. But he goes into length explaining like why he thinks he caught this fish. And it was at exactly the same time of day. He reckons it's something to do with light levels and this particular glow bug. And this fish was rare as hell, and he caught it twice really quickly. I don't know if it was 2 days or a week apart or whatever. Two sessions apart.
Yeah, but what's that glow bug imitating?
Exactly, something like
there's something about it.
It's like when you're catching glow in the dark corn, you know what I mean?
It doesn't really matter.
Is it just the factor of they're intrigued and they're picking it up to
the thing is we don't know the answer, it's our heads, isn't it?
Yeah, we don't know the answer. What we
that's
do
it, but it's nice to hear other people's opinions on what they think it is, you know.
Using the glow bug during that time. I think there's always an answer for something in nature that you can look something else to equate to. So I used to question everything and you know be really anal about everything, and now I'm just like, well, I've seen that happen 3 times now, that'll do for me. I'll stop questioning it and just do it. If it appear, you know,
yeah, but it's pointless doing it if you don't understand.
That's what I said, John, at all. You need to understand why you are doing it. Even if you've got it for the wrong idea, if you start to think about what you're doing, then you'll get better.
I'd
like to know why. I mean, one of the best stories that didn't come from me is a lad that I fished with on Colmere years ago called Alex. He explained the spread baiting theory to me, and he got it off his dog. So him and his mate Elliot Frazier, who does some writing in mags.
Yeah, Shropshire.
Yeah, that's right, Shropshire lads. That's where I met him. Very good thinking anglers. They're talking about spread baiting. They've called it the dog in the pub theory. So they're in the pub and they're local together, and they've got Elliot's dog with him, or Alex's, I think it was Elliot's, and they've got the peanuts off the bar, and they've poured this bowl of peanuts on the floor there, and the dog's just ate them all, 5 seconds flat, it's wagging its tail going, where's the rest, give me some more food, right? So they've then got the next bowl of peanuts off the bar, and they've held the dog and they've spread them all around the bar. One over there, one over there, one over there, one over there, one over there. Took the dog 20 minutes to find them all. But when it had found them all, it didn't know it had found them all. It's looking about going, it's not coming to you going, where's the next bowl of food? It's still going that corner. It's going over there going, where are they?
Yeah.
It's ate them all. It doesn't even know it's ate them all. So that to me is like a spread baiting theory. Apply that to carp. If you put all your bait in one thing, they're in the next peg. Yeah. They've gone down.
Well, if you spread it around, they're still looking.
Spread it around. They don't even know it's gone when it's gone. So they're still looking, and the whole thing.
When they find one, they'll just.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're dropping their guard because they're going, there's another. There's another. And if that one there is your bait, like, they've dropped the guard. They're just like that. They're excited, charging around, and that for me is one of the best analogies from a dog. But it completely explains why spread baiting works. So when I spot, I'm aiming at that marker. One's gone over there. It's deliberate.
We went through that earlier, didn't we?
I think you can find an analogy similar to animals. Are animals? They behave generally the same as humans, right? We all react to food. Survival, sex, like there's pretty much everything you can equate down to one of those three things. And animals are the same. They're trying to eat, they're trying to procreate, and they're looking to stay alive, like without getting hurt, caught, hooked,
with less hassle,
whatever. And if you can tick all those boxes, just think generally you can work out a reason why. Why do they get scared of lines? Well, because why do they not move on winds than they used to? Well, because there's 20 leads can land on the end of a wind every time.
But when they first started, there wasn't 20 leads landing on. That's why they moved off the wind.
Yeah.
But now, you, and that's why thought process is the biggest game changer. The guys who think more catch more. Occasionally, somebody will get lucky.
Yeah.
But the guys that think more, in the law of averages, overseas will catch
more. The person that thinks more, he's going, why does that duffer over there just have a 10 fish hit?
Yeah.
Like he might have dropped right, but why was it right? And you've just got to think, well...
You store it away as an equation.
I know a load of lakes that used to fish on the winds, and now they fish in the back of the wind. The fish actively go to the back of the wind.
Yeah.
It's pressure that's done that. Nothing more, nothing less. Why do many matches when you see a load of guys turn up on a... I mean, how many fish a year, Matt, does Peg 9 do in here? It
not
wins
very
almost
many.
Every match that it has on it.
And that's that is
because
the
nobody goes down there. They never even peg the peg. They've turned up in fish in Peg 9 this week. There's less people on here than there is on a normal weekend on angling. There's still a few fish.
And which goes back
there.
To us talking about Peg 17 being the most prolific swim on the lake. And
no pressure
scenes,
on the guy in Peg 17 then.
Off the scenes, we said, you know, Peg 17, you know, if you turned up here blind, we was picking that exactly. And then it switched around.
He'll catch six tonight.
Quite often, the peg with nobody in it is where the fish are.
Yeah.
And on every busy lake.
Yeah.
You take,
they're moving off the pressure all the time, aren't they?
No anglers. I'd take that any day over a lake with 20 anglers.
I mean,
it's
look at the bay up in 11 and 12's got managed to get amongst some fish, but that's been empty now for 4 or 5 days, you know what I mean? So the fish have moved in there off the
and
angling
it's,
pressure.
It's,
you know?
It's easy to say in hindsight, shit, I should have just gone in 11, yeah. But like that's what fish do. They go, there's lines over there, there's lines there, there's lines there, there's lines there, where isn't? And the amount of people I know that they're Friday nighters, they finish work, they're the last one to arrive on the lake, they get the shitty peg nobody wants, they catch the biggest fish in the lake. Because that fish has gone shit.
And the trick is to retain that. Is the trick is you can't do anything about where you are landing, but you can retain that knowledge for next time. So next time you come down, the lake's full, and there are three pegs left. There's one in the middle of the hotspot area, and there's a corner that nobody's in. You can say, oh, I want to go in the middle and chuck out in the middle like everybody else. Or do I think the fish might be down in that corner like they were last week when it was quiet? The thinking angler will go in that area, whereas the bloke who just does the same, don't think about it, will go, oh, I need to go in the middle, because they're always in the middle.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is what is a game changer, the ability to have an open mind, but to retain what you learn. Every time you blank, there's nothing wrong with that, if you retain why you blank.
Yeah, if you're learning from it.
I never blanked without learning something.
You'll learn something.
Yeah, they're definitely
you might have
the
just
same.
Learned the features in the swim you're in. You might have learned somebody else catching
about pink bait,
something so you can come back and then utilise that again to put your more fish on the bank. And I was saying that about a couple of lads earlier. I noticed today, you're 24 hours into your social, and I noticed today a lot of lads are making the changes. They've only been here 24 hours. And what I was trying to explain to a couple of lads earlier, they found a spot yesterday that I was happy with, and they applied bait in there and fished, then today I've moved off that spot, you know, to try and nick a fish before they go. But what I'm saying to them is, by moving that rod 4 rod lengths to the right and going a little bit further out, the chances are that the fish are on that original spot now eating the grub, because there's no lines there.
Everybody here has been in this situation, like, you've got down on the lake for 48 hours on the weekend or whenever you've arrived on the lake. You've got a preconceived plan in your head before you've got there. You're thinking, right, that's the peg to be in, I want to be in that peg. You've got in there, you've spotted your bucket of bait out on the 2 or 3 spots in that peg. You've sat there for 24 hours, caught nothing, and you've seen 3 fish show in 3 pegs down. And you've gone,
I'll bait it up,
they're
so I'm
near
not
enough. I'm going to stay where I am in case they move on to my bait, rather than just move to where the fish are and not stay where you are. Now, I've done that a million times.
And it pays
in
off in both
years,
ways,
I've
though.
I've moved for that last night, whatever emphasis costs, put a rod down, caught straight away and gone, why didn't I do that for the last 15 years of my fishing career? Like,
that's what
but then if we reverse that, you could move,
they're gonna find it,
someone could drop into your swim, get on your spot straight away and start doing fish, and then you're kicking yourself in the balls again.
That's
what
you're worried
about, isn't it? You don't want somebody else to move onto your spot. And I've had that.
Well, that's it. We could just go around in circles here, couldn't we?
Dave Lane, there are people who fish like Dave Lane who will be constantly active. They're always moving, changing, that will catch loads of fish. And there are people who will just go for the dogmatic single approach because they know that X, Y and Z equals and generally adds up. It's what you're confident in.
Yeah.
You know, you can't all fish like Dave Lane, because if I fish like Dave Lane was constant, I'd be knackered. I'd be absolutely knackered. But there again, I can't sit like a long stay angler and just say they're going to come to me eventually. I'm somewhere in the middle. But you know, it's whatever.
I think you got more chance catching the big fish with a plan
yeah.
and fish by like reacting to the situation.
You'll catch more fish by reacting.
Yeah, that's it. Whereas sit on your rods fish, unless you see something that triggers you to make.
If you know what, if you evaluate what that big fish falls to, that big fish tends to caught in March or September, on this, on that, caught there, doing this, doing that, you are more likely to catch that big fish. You're going to catch a lot less fish, where a guy who's more open to change, he will catch more fish. Definitely. But he probably won't catch the one he wants.
Yeah, yeah, you know, that's the thing.
It's, you know, it's, they are creatures of habit that will change, but they will eventually go back.
I'd have to say, yeah.
I'm sure everyone's itching to get rods out before dark, aren't they?
Yeah, we need to go. Right, Jill, thanks, Jill.
I was just trying to keep your show running.
All right, get those rods out.
Check out the website at www.thecapcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.